Welcome, everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 187 on the motherfucking cop.
What?
I'm your host, Snoop Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, John Lindemann.
A.K.A. J-Dog.
This is pretty much Christmas for John. Whenever you can insert 187 into your daily conversation.
I'm shining my gat right now, Johnny.
Oh, God.
You just heard James Jones.
I'm afraid.
Who is the thuggish, ruggish bone.
Probably more and bone than thuggish or ruggish.
Nice. It just goes...
And Greg Leahy.
I'm supposed to be contrarian. I have to refer to myself as something like Wilberforce Farthington now, wasn't it?
No. I think you're actually the alter ego of Slick Rick, aren't you?
I don't think so.
So, we are excited about this show today. It's going to have a little bit of interesting structure. I'm only here for the first segment, and then these guys will take over after the break and talk about, I guess, killing stuff off.
The inmates are running the asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, we're going, I think, deeply into giant bomb territory here, and that we are actually using the 187 murder thing as a motif for this episode. So I won't be participating in that part of it, but you're gonna like it. It will make it gaming related. Don't worry. Oh, yeah, by the way, actually, while I'm still here and while I'm thinking about it, it's about 2 weeks until PAX East.
Word.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, I should start planning that. It's on my to-do list, actually. This weekend, I'm gonna sketch out some notes for it, and we'll start talking about what we're going to do for it. But, yeah, it's coming up really soon. I'm getting excited.
Got my tickets, and I got my room. That's all the planet I need. Just don't show up naked. We're good to go.
Yeah.
I can't guarantee that.
And I found out that, this will segue into my first game for new business, but I found out that Grapple Buggy is going to be there in playable form at PAX East. And Grapple Buggy is the new game from Mommy's Best Games, the indie developer who brought us Weapon of Choice, one of the inaugural Xbox Live indie games, which is fantastic, and they've actually lowered the price recently, so I think it's only $2 or $3. It's one of the best Contra style run and gun games you will ever play. So if you have an Xbox 360, I really highly encourage you to play it. I mean, you can play it for like 10 minutes on the free trial.
Yep.
And the same actually goes for Shoot One Up, which is the other game that I picked up this week from the same developer. And Shoot One Up is a very unusual shoot 'em up in which, instead of just controlling one ship, most of the time you're actually controlling what they call a phalanx of several ships, up to 30. I haven't actually gotten above 20, and even at that, it's hard to tell what's going on. There's so much shit on the screen. So I can't imagine what it looks like when you've got 30 ships, plus enemies and bosses and stuff, and bullets everywhere. But it's a very crazy game. It's a lot of fun. It costs $1. And actually, the really funny thing is I've had 80 Microsoft points on my account for quite a while, and you can't really buy anything for $1.
Oh, it's a scam.
Xbox. Right, you can't even buy a Rock Band song for $1. So it's just, in most cases. So it's just been sitting there for a while, and I looked at the price. I'm like, this is 80 points. That equals $1. So I was like, oh, dude, that's perfect. So I played the trial again for about 10 minutes. It was a very generous free trial on Shoot One Up. Without second thought, I burned the buck on it because it's actually worth a lot more than $1. It's really good. It is kind of a bullet hell shooter, but it's actually quite a bit easier than a lot of other shoot 'em ups, I think. It's vertically scrolling, and like I said, you control like this phalanx of ships, but you control them all at the same time, so they just kind of move around as a unit. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a fuzzy unit, so I would liken it maybe a little bit to like Options and Gradius, where they sort of, you know, they keep some kind of formation, but they kind of move in and out depending on the situation and stuff like that. Especially if you've played Gradius 5, where you can actually control the formations, there's a little bit of that to it. But basically, they just kind of spread out in a sort of circular-ish pattern. But you can use the shoulder triggers to contract and expand the formation, depending on the situation. You know, if you need to dodge big enemies, you can contract it down. Or if there are enemies all over the place, you might actually want to expand it out to spread your shots out wider. The other thing is, if your ships are spread out far enough, and as you hold down the button, they'll start to collect energy in the center of their formation, and it'll form this ball of energy that then shoots out a giant laser up to the top of the screen, which is really by far the best way to kill bosses and large enemies. So it's tricky because in a boss especially, you'd probably would prefer to keep your spread down low so that you can more easily avoid the big attacks from the enemies. But it behooves you to keep it at least out to a medium spread so that you can use this giant laser, which makes the boss a lot easier. So there's a really nice tension between, you know, trying to be conservative with moving around and not losing too many of your ships, and yet being aggressive enough with your spread that you can actually get the really good firepower that you need to play the game. And, you know, this is all adaptive. You're moving it in and out all the time. Actually, one of the really interesting things is as you push the formation towards the edge of the screen, they'll start to bunch up together because they can't fly off the edge of the screen. So they bunch up, and then you move away from the screen, and they're still bunched up. So you actually kind of have to think about, you know, where you are in position to the edges, and, you know, you have to kind of reform your spread after you do this stuff. It's some interesting stuff. And, I mean, aside from all of that, which is all pretty unique to shoot one up, I think, the actual shoot 'em up gameplay is really good. It's really good. The graphics are great. The music is okay. I think the music could actually use a little bit of work. But this is like one guy developed this. I mean, I think he outsources a couple of pieces of it. But this is pretty much a one-man studio, and he's now working on his third game. And they're all released through Xbox Indie Games, that channel, and they're all super cheap and like really shockingly good. So I would really recommend people go get it, especially if you're into shoot 'em ups, and especially if you think a lot of shoot 'em ups are too hard for you, because this one is actually in the description. It says that it's kind of a shoot 'em up for the normal person.
It's interesting. It's like you don't really see that much with shoot 'em ups. They're either super hard or they don't even bother. It's like they've almost made themselves an incredibly niche genre.
And the nice thing is it's not really dumbed down at all, because it's actually pretty complicated, you know, with all the stuff I was talking about, but it's just balanced so that it's easier. Like, the first time I played it, I got to, like, the third boss. And, you know, I could do it again knowing what I know now and, you know, about how the game plays and actually get even farther than that. There's also an interesting extra mode called Score Trek. And the idea there is that you only get one ship ever. There are no one-ups or anything. So you have one ship to try to play through the entire game. But it kind of accumulates your score as you play it over and over again. It's weird. There's kind of a... It's a bit like a shoot 'em up roguelike. I don't really know the intricacies of how it's set up, because I've only just barely touched it, but it sounds pretty interesting. So there, it does have two very distinct modes to it as well. So anyway, that's a good segue into my other game that I've been playing pretty heavily this past week, which is Sharon the Wanderer for DS. And actually, the official title is Mystery Dungeon : Sharon the Wanderer, if you're trying to find a copy of it and having any trouble. So, James, you only played the Pokemon ones, right?
In the last decade and a half, yes. In retrospect, I have played games that are roguelikes, but although I was unfamiliar with the term at the time.
Really? What were they?
I can't remember what they were called, but just hearing described, I was like, yes, that game sounds like a roguelike now that I think about it. Like old PC games.
Oh, like the ASCII stuff?
They're not that old, but, you know, like very, very simple sprites.
Yeah, okay. I this is definitely my first time with the genre, and I have been very pleasantly surprised by how much I'm enjoying it. Now, with Sharon, there are moments that just make me want to... It's weird because with Mega Man 9, sometimes I feel like throwing the controller. You know, that game is hard, but you can just immediately try again. You know, I mean, at most you might have to play through a stage. So you don't really lose that much when you die. And in Sharon, it's like, well, dying is kind of part of the game. And when you die, you're going to lose some shit that it may take you hours to get back to it. And you can't really get that angry about it, because it's like, when you're playing through the game, it feels like your death is inevitable. It's just a matter of when it happens and how much you can accomplish before it happens that might actually carry over to future playthroughs. So, you know, when I heard Andy Gergen talking about this on Newscast, he was playing the Wii version of Sharon. When I heard all the guys on 1UP's Active Time Babble podcast, when they did their roguelike episode... One thing that didn't really stick with me, and it was something I didn't really understand until I played the DS game for myself, is that there are several side quests, at least in the Sharon games. I can't speak for other roguelikes, because they may not all be like this. But in the Sharon games, because it's kind of it's set up more like an RPG in that you do go through towns, you talk to people, sometimes they help you out, or that, you know, there are shops where you can buy things. So because of these RPG trappings, there are little side quests in the game that you can actually work on through multiple playthroughs. So one thing that I was surprised a bit by is that I thought when you died in the game, which everybody says, you know, you die a lot and then you lose everything. Well, what happens is when you die, you go back to the beginning of the game, but it's not like it erased everything that you did. So you lose all your items and your experience goes back to one. Your level goes back to one. But people, when you play through it a second time, all the people that you talked to before will remember you. Anything that you did to help them out will still be accumulated, in other words. And so, and there are also these storehouses where you can put items in there to save them for later. And then if you die, when you come back to that storehouse the next time around, all the stuff that you stored in there will be there. So you can actually kind of set yourself up and leave things for yourself on future playthroughs. So there's almost a, not a karmic system, but it is like there's a way to kind of plan ahead. There are actually ways to sort of build up your weapons over time. So let's say you get a good katana. You can forge it at the blacksmith and use some scrolls on it to upgrade it so it gets more powerful. And then if you're running low on food or money or whatever and you feel like you probably won't survive a whole lot longer, you can put that sword that you've worked on in a storehouse and then go ahead and die whenever it happens to happen. And then when you come back through next time, you'll just pick up that sword and then you can go and forge it again and upgrade it more and more. So you can actually build things up over time this way. And with a side quest, it's interesting too, because I've given people herbs, I've given people rice balls, I've helped people set up a restaurant, I found a lost little girl and returned her to her parents, which then opened up a storehouse, and all these things are persistent. So if you die, it's okay. The next time you go through, those things will still have been done. You haven't lost everything, you've still actually made some progress in the overall structure of the game. And a lot of times what happens, and what I'm finding, especially today as I played more and more, is that a lot of these things that you do in the beginning may not seem like they help you that much to begin with. But as you complete several of these side quests and you really accumulate a lot of progress within the game, as you play through on later lives, the effect of all these things really adds up, and it actually helps you get a lot farther in the game and do a lot better than you ever could before. So it does feel like I'm actually making progress. At this point, I've probably died a dozen times and had to restart. And yet, the time that I went through today, I've made it much farther than I ever have before, and it was easier for the most part than it was in the past. So I do feel like over time, it gets easier, you know, even though it is very brutally difficult at first. And there's always a threat of, like, spontaneous death, because the game is so random. Anyway, to summarize my point, I'm surprised that I'm finding there are actually some comparisons to be made with stuff like Majora's Mask, in which, yes, the game resets every 3 days or whatever, 3 days of game time. But there are, you know, things you can do primarily in that game, getting masks that give you abilities or give you, you know, let you talk to certain people or whatever. Or even just information, you know, putting things in your notebook, that doesn't go away when you reset. So it's always about, well, I have a finite amount of time here. I'm going to do as much as I can within that time and try to do something that will be permanent. And then when I start over, I won't have to do that part again. I'll be able to progress beyond that. And Shirin the Wanderer, it has a very similar feeling. The difference here, and what can be really frustrating about it, is that you don't have a finite amount of time. You don't know when you're going to die.
Yeah.
So it makes it harder to plan ahead. It sometimes makes it difficult to do these kind of grand strategies. It's usually more about trying to do the smartest thing in the moment with what you have at hand.
I think the primary difference, though, is that when you die in Shirin the Wanderer, you lose all of your things like your level and your physical attributes that you've upgraded, whereas in Majora's Mask, you're not suddenly made weak and nerfed again.
Yeah, you don't lose all your heart containers, and so the parallel is not direct.
It's true.
Yeah, I could see the similarity to the persistence of the world.
I mean, you remember in Majora's Mask, you do lose any rupees that you haven't put away in the bank.
Yeah.
You lose bombs, arrows, sticks.
It's very much
like
the storehouse sort of thing there, but just for money.
But right? I usually had the bank so stocked with cash that I could roll.
Yeah. Once you kind of realize what's going on there, it's pretty trivial. trivial, right. But it's kind of neat.
Yeah, in terms of money, the way Sheeran does it, I think, is actually more balanced, in that there is no way to store away money. So money is a very fleeting, ethereal thing. You know, when you get it, you want to spend it, because there's not a whole lot of reason to save it up, because you might just die and lose it all.
Or lose whatever you bought with it.
And the same goes for items. You pick up a useful item, there's not a really a very strong case for keeping that around, you know, for a long time, because you may not live long enough to ever use it. So when you get in a bad situation, you better use whatever you've got.
What about the how the level kind of design shakes out in terms of the procedurally generated aspect? I mean, you can have this random element without it being really dysfunctional, I think, but does it manage that?
The random level design sometimes comes up with pretty interesting levels. Sometimes they're very boring. Sometimes they're just confusing. James is absolutely correct that quite often you will spawn near the exit to that floor.
Yeah.
The difference is, or one thing that James never mentioned, I'm not sure if it's because you didn't appreciate this or maybe you just didn't care, but if all you care about is getting to the next floor, then that's actually nice because you could just go. Or the stairs are also the way you go back a floor. If you want to kind of work your way backwards towards the town.
That's different right there, because you can't go backwards in the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon.
Yeah,
game.
In Sheeran you can. Now, I haven't found any kind of escape scrolls or anything like that, so you kind of have to work your way methodically if you want to go backwards to a previous town. But there is a way to do that. So the stairways are actually very useful, but a lot of times when I'm playing through a floor, I'll locate the stairs so I know where they are. And then I'll go around and explore the rest of the floor to clean it out of enemies and items and gain experience and things like that. So knowing where the exit is doesn't mean you're done with that floor a lot of times. Mm. It means that, okay, now I know how to get out when I'm ready. Or, you know, if a monster is chasing you, then you head straight for the stairs and hope you can get out before you die. So, yeah, the fact that you spawn right next to the exit point, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. It's a bad level design. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean the random feature let you down.
Or it doesn't render that particular part just irrelevant, which kind of sounds like it did in the Pokemon.
The point of the game is not necessarily to jump through the levels as fast as possible. You know, it's to build up your character and get strong. And in this game, and Pokemon, Mystery Dungeon, I've heard is so easy that this might not ever be a factor. But in Sheeran the Wanderer, if you just run straight through 3 or 4 levels of the dungeon, just going straight to the exit and not killing anything or picking up any items, you're totally screwed, because you'll be so underleveled and your equipment will be so inadequate by the time you actually do run into something that you can't just run away from, that you'll be dead immediately. So it actually pays off to be more patient and more thorough in exploring each floor.
I would have thought the severe penalty for dying would sort of instill a natural conservatism anyway, really.
It does, but there's always a trade-off, because, you know, spending a lot of time running around the floor and looking for things will use up your fullness and your stomach. So if you're short on food, you might want to just hurry through the levels and try to get to a town where you can buy more rice balls or something like that. The other interesting thing, I think this is a really cool feature, is that you can spin turns. You know, basically you can just kind of speed up through time, which gives if there's any monsters around, it gives them a turn, so they can approach you, they can attack you or whatever. But if you're kind of in a safe area with no monsters, you can actually basically just sit there and regenerate your health. And likewise, you can also just regenerate health by walking around. Now, the really interesting balance to that is the fullness meter. Because if you never use any healing items, basically, and you just kind of sit around all the time and wait for your health to regenerate, then you'll go hungry really fast and you'll run out of food and die. So there's always a question of, well, should I use an item now to heal, or should I walk around a little bit and let it do it naturally? The fullness meter adds a tension to the game. It's almost like a time limit, but it's a highly adjustable time limit based on the items that you buy or that you find.
Yeah, the thing about the Mystery Dungeon games is basically you have the ability to eat every 10 minutes. Absolutely massive metabolism.
Yeah. No, there's nothing realistic about it. I just look at it as a mechanic.
But, oh, yeah. To propel you forward, probably, because, again, there is a tendency to be conservative, and if you've got this ability to heal with that, if it didn't have that as a counterbalance, then you probably have some, you know, however the seemingly not fun it might be, there would probably be people who would still just crawl around at a snail's pace and play the game.
Absolutely. The fullness meter keeps you from grinding too much. You can grind a little bit, although it's usually not actually that good of an idea, because you will run out of food. And as you get deeper in the dungeon, food is easy to get at the beginning of the game. It's harder to get later. So as you get later in the dungeon, you really don't want to be grinding. You kind of want to do your business, pick up the most useful stuff you can find, and move on. I mean, as you can probably tell, I do like the game, and I've had a lot of frustrating moments with it. There have been times when I thought, man, just really, there should be a shop in this town. Why isn't there a damn shop here? Why isn't there a storage house in this town? It's ridiculous. So there are things that I would change about it, but overall, I'm very pleasantly surprised with how much I'm enjoying it. And most of all, I just think it's totally fascinating. It's a super interesting game, and every time you go through it, it's different, because there's so much randomness, and it's not just in the level design, it's the items that you come across, it's the enemies that you come across, it's the weird interactions. I was thinking a couple days ago that one thing Andy said when he was talking about the Wii game is that every time you die, at least you learn something about the game. And I think I would correct that slightly. I don't think it's you necessarily learn something from dying, but I think you learn something from everything you did up until you died. From playing the game, you always learn something new. And it's just because the game is so fucking complicated. There's so many items, there's so many enemies, there's so many strange interactions among all these different things. The strategy of moving around on this grid and you know, knowing when to move diagonally, knowing when to wait a turn, knowing when to attack or at what angle or which enemies to attack when you've got a group. There's just a lot to learn about. And the tutorial, well, there is no tutorial. The characters will give you hints, which are useful. But there's no way they could tell you everything that goes on in the game. I mean, you just kind of have to experience it and get a feel for how the mechanics all fit together. So you do learn a lot about that, and that's another thing that helps you get farther and farther and farther as you play it more and more. I don't know if I would recommend it to everybody, but I'm very glad that I picked it up. It has been a hell of an education for me the past week, and it's been an enjoyable one. I'm actually finding the game's quite addictive. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say. If you guys have any questions or...
what's the length of the levels in this game? Like a number of floors or things? Is it like 5 floors, 10 floors, or are we in like Pokemon territory where it was 60?
Oh, God, no. Okay. Usually there are about 5 floors between each town.
Because I think both when Neil and I played that game, the biggest problem with it was the fact that there were 60-plus floors in a dungeon. So the mechanics basically went from being a challenge just being an irritant.
Right. Yeah, that does not sound good. I mean, if Sharon had that many floors, you know, if you just cram that into what already exists in the game, the game would be completely impossible, for one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you need that break. Every 5 or 6 floors, you need a town to show up where you can stay at the inn and buy some herbs. That is necessary because the game is challenging. So, yeah, I mean, from everything I've heard, James, I think you would probably like this a lot more than Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, but I don't know if you would like it enough to actually like it.
You know? It's a lot less impossible, basically.
I just don't know about your taste.
I would just like to kind of open the floor to James. I just want to let him know that if he wants to do a review of it, certainly Andy can send his copy over and we can get a second opinion on it.
I'll tell you what, John, you review Explorers of the Sky and I'll review this, but you have to complete it. You have to not just complete it, you have to complete both stories if there's a second one.
Oh, dear.
I don't know. Let me think
John
about that.
John will die before that happens.
Obviously, Johnny, you haven't played both the console and the DS. You've just played the DS. But, I mean, could you see yourself playing this kind of game on a console? Is it more something that's appropriate for a handheld?
Well, I actually was interested in the Wii version after playing this. So a few days ago, I watched a trailer on YouTube. Or I watched like a video review from some YouTube author guy of the Wii version, because I wanted to see what it looks like in motion and how it compares. I mean, it looks extremely similar to the DS game. I mean, the graphics actually look really nice on the Wii, but in terms of the way the game is played, it's definitely from the same series. I mean, it is striking the similarity. So it sounds like I'm not sure if I would actually want to own both, just because I think they're probably so much alike. I mean, I would definitely play this if I had it on the console, but it is the kind of game I think actually works better on a portable, because especially because there's no real-time element at all. I mean, if you just, you know, if you just set it down, nothing's going to happen. The enemies only move when you move. They only attack when you attack.
Right.
So it is turn-based, although not in the Final Fantasy sense, and in kind of a different sense, it's turn-based. And I think it works very well for portables. I've been watching TV and movies quite a bit this week while I play it. And, you know, if something catches my interest on TV, then I just look up. You know, I don't have to worry about, oh my God, what's going to happen on the game. So it's very much like a Pokemon or something like that in that sense, you know, in terms of just, it's probably something you would rather play on a handheld. So anyway, that's Shiren the Wanderer. It's definitely been the most interesting gaming I've done in a while. Thanks for bearing with me through all that. So, James, I think you're up next with more RPGs.
Yeah, more, relatively speaking, RPG. So I did finish off Dragon Age, which is kind of like the worst ending in an RPG I've ever played.
Oh, yeah, though he's going to be more measured with your comments this week.
No, look. It is the least climactic boss battle I've ever seen. I'm just going to leave it at that. But I defend my position that the game's battle system isn't super interesting, although people have argued otherwise, because how they advise playing... Now, they say the PC version is the, quote, supreme version of the game, and that may be, but the 360 version got good reviews too, so... The biggest issue that I have with it is that the way they say you should play it is you should basically attack, stop, go to your next person, issue them commands for attack, stop, go to the third, then go to the fourth, and then go back to yourself, which really slows the seemingly endless waves of combat down to the point where I feel like it would make the game twice as long.
That sounds just like an old-school Final Fantasy or something.
Yeah, but except it's the battle itself is still real-time. The only thing that's stopping is the fact that you've basically paused the game so you could enter an order.
Okay.
It'd be like playing a first-person shooter squad-based and having to control all four of your characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just bogs it down.
Yeah, and so playing it like that didn't seem to be very appealing, although I gave it a try, and surprisingly, it wasn't. So the best middle ground I can come up with is picking the character of the four you have with you that's either the most useful or the most entertaining in the current situation, which makes it better, but still, the combat itself is probably the game's weakest asset. But what I found is that the game's characters are probably actually its best asset, which is interesting for this game in particular because there's a ton of them. I think there's like 16 characters or something along those lines.
That is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of them is distinct and interacts with the others in a unique way, depending on your relationship with them.
So does that make you want to play through it all over again?
A little bit. A little bit.
You said last week that you wouldn't.
Yeah, well, not right away, but it's like there are characters that, you know, when you're walking and they'll be talking behind you to each other, and just the kind of conversations they have, it's dependent on who you have with you, and they're almost always amusing. I'm not particularly interested in the add-on they've got coming out, because basically they've cut a lot of the character stuff out of it. You can't do relationship stuff, which is kind of one of the interesting things of the game, how it causes your relationships to and your interactions to change. So it's kind of seems more like it's just here's more levels or more dungeons, go in there and don't die.
Yeah, I think a lot of DLC packs or expansion packs kind of make that mistake. They end up ignoring what people really like about the game in the first place in favor of just adding more content of the type that is easiest to make.
Yeah. And it's a lot of new content. It's a whole lot of new content. I mean, it's basically a new story, but they don't really have any of that whole character development stuff, at least doesn't seem so. That is really what made that game so much fun to play.
Do you know if that's like an old school, like $20 PC expansion pack?
It's like $32.
Whoa.
It's huge. I mean, it's a gigantic add-on.
That's weird. It seems like, and I'm not a huge PC gamer, you know, but it seems like that trend has fallen off in recent years. So it seems like very few games actually have expansion packs anymore.
I used to have tons of games with and their expansion packs, and I don't think I've bought an expansion pack in years. It's just not come up. What's sad is that basically at the end of the game, you can't go back and complete quests you left unfinished, which this might be a little bit of a spoiler, but you should know this before you go do it, because I didn't. And so what happens is you're dropped in your camp when you load up your completed game save, which is where all your party members are and you can interact with them and have these weird conversations where they like talk to your dog and just crazy shit. But you can't leave your camp unless you go buy DLC. Then you can go play those DLC missions. But if you don't have the DLC, you're stuck in camp. Which is like the ultimate screw you job I've ever seen in a game to sell DLC. Granted, if you buy the game new, you get a little bit of DLC for free, but not all of it.
So, as we all know, the cure for too much BioWare is...
is more BioWare, yeah. Before I go into this, I went to GameStop on the day Final Fantasy XIII came out, because I'm an imbecile. Oh, actually, it was like 7 p.m. and the game was coming out at midnight. And because I didn't think, hey, Final Fantasy XIII comes out tonight, maybe I should wait a day. And no, because the whole place was just stupid. Like, people in costume and just ridiculous crap. But
James was one of them? James was cosplaying with the best
I was,
of them?
That was the quickest shopping trip I've ever made to GameStop. Because I usually go in not knowing what I'm going to buy. But in this case, I went in and I had an intention of getting Tales of Vesperia. Because, mm-hmm. honestly, I need more RPGs.
Yeah. More Tales games, specifically.
And James says that like he's afraid that he's going to become the RPG guy on staff, but you're sure as hell not the Ace Combat guy anymore.
Well, there aren't any Ace Combat games to play, John.
I'm just saying, man.
What if there was an Ace Combat RPG?
Mm. I would have to quit the podcast because mm-hmm. I would basically be spending all my time with
yep.
it.
James joins us from the cockpit.
I'd have to completely reconfigure my office to just look like an aircraft cockpit.
That is role-playing in a rather more literal sense, isn't it?
That's more obsessive than anything.
Yeah.
But they didn't have it, which was a little bit distressing. Aww. Because I had seen it, I guess, a few weeks earlier, and I'm like, no, no.
Nice patronizing, Greg.
Yes.
If you want more, then we say patronizing, John.
Oh.
I just got that. Man. Very clever. Well played.
Oh, man.
The fact that it took long to get is probably the worst part of it.
Oh, man.
It gives a little extra
sting. At first,
sting.
I was like, what?
I was like, oh, I see what you did there.
But because I know I don't buy games at $60, I realized I was going to have to wait for Mass Effect 2 for a while. But it was there, and they had a used copy of it, and basically pretty much new condition. And it looked like they still had little DLC code slip in there, unused.
Oh, did they?
I believe so. I haven't tried it yet.
Ah.
And, you know, I have the membership card that dropped it to $49. So
nice.
I basically grabbed that and then got out of there before the clerk engaged me wearing his elf ears because I didn't need that. Drove immediately home and cried for a few hours and then began what has become 20 hours of Mass Effect 2 in 3 days.
Woo!
It grabbed you somewhat more than it did Johnny then.
This is not good for my health because I played like the problem with this game is like you're like I'm having a little bit of fun but it's not great and you look and it's like oh god 4 hours passed what happened
yeah, yeah.
and that's the worst kind of game for me as a person because I fall for that shit easy.
So you're saying that it's only a little bit of fun, Mass Effect 2?
No, it's not like oh my god this is the most fun I've ever had but it's like it's casual you know I can enjoy it. Kind of relaxed and stuff.
Interesting look at the word casual. 4 hours
yeah,
going
exactly.
In, disappearing here and there casually.
It's the Farmville of third-person shooters slash RPGs from
Bioware. I'm not on the edge of my seat playing it. Does that make sense?
But it is absorbing. I
yeah,
suppose,
and then you look
it?
And yeah. You're like, well, what happened?
It's the story, right, that makes it so absorbing.
Well, it also has a big world, too, so you can just kind of get lost in it and just kind of wander around and meander, if
right.
you will.
That is a deadly combination. That's what happened to me with the first Mass Effect. I mean, I played that game very heavily for a few days because for the same reason.
Yeah, I got lost in the game, and it was just like, oh god, here it comes. And you just explore for a while and then find your way back. But right now, there was until I played the game till 3:30 in the morning last night. there were like 9 missions I could go on at the same time. So I was like, well, they take about 10-15 to maybe 40 minutes. I can get one more in. I can get one more in. And then when I realized, oh, God, I beat 7 of them. What happened?
God. Oh, God, I ate the whole thing.
Yeah,
pretty much.
That's scary.
But what's interesting is that while there are a similar number of characters in this game, they aren't nearly as developed as they were in Dragon Age, which I thought was kind of weird because this isn't their first run-through in this franchise. You know, they spend more time on you know, like the races and the lore than Dragon Age does, although there is quite a lot of it.
But most of the characters in Mass Effect 2 are actually new characters.
Yes, they are
right?
New characters, but they fill some of the same archetypes that previous characters had resided in. And there's not as much tie-in to my previous gameplay as I was expecting. I don't know why. Like, a lot of times you'll just run into somebody from the previous game that was a minor character that there's no way in hell you remember, unless you played the game, like, an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll make a comment about something you did that you equally don't remember. And then you'll have the choice of, that was a tough decision, or she deserved it. And you're like, well, I guess it was a tough decision. I don't remember doing it.
Wasn't that tough, was it?
And then you'll get some story, and you're like, well, that was pointless. Glad we went through that.
You know, James, I feel like, and this explains why I haven't played more of Mass Effect 2. I mean, I was slightly exaggerating last time when I said I'd put it in for like 5 minutes. It's probably more like 15. Mm-hmm. But seriously, like, the first opportunity to save and quit, I did. And that's because the only reason I really did it was I wanted to put in my code for the free DLC before I lost the card.
Yeah.
Because I own Mass Effect 2, so I can always go back to it.
Right.
And so when I'm renting games or downloading games, stuff like that, a lot of these other things will take priority over it just because I have all the time in the world to play Mass Effect 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, once I start playing it, I will not have all the time in the world.
Yeah, you know you have to clear your calendar for it because you're going to get sucked into
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
To comment on the DRPGification of this series, you have 4 stats. And I was a friend of mine who the same guy who played Dragon Age 1,000 times, he's still waiting for this game to be shipped to him because he ordered it during Amazon's deal of the day yesterday. It was like $30 for PC. And I was explaining it to him, and he's like, well, tell me how RPG-ish it is, because I've heard it's really not. And he almost hit the ceiling when I said it's only got 4 stats per character.
That's bullshit. That's out of context, though. I mean, Dragon Quest probably has about 4 stats per character.
Yeah, I guess, but they're kind of like, this is your ability to use, like, fiery shells.
Like I said, I've barely played Mass Effect 2, but from what I've heard about it and read about it, I think they're actually going in the right direction. Because my problem with the first Mass Effect, and it wasn't a huge beef with the game, but one thing that kind of annoyed me was the loot element of it. I'm not a loot whore at all. And I get kind of annoyed in games like that and Torchlight, which we'll hear about in a minute, I guess, but I get annoyed with games that just shove equipment at you nonstop, and you end up spending half the game just going through your menus and throwing away stuff that you don't need. But like, it's just basically, is this better than what I have? No? Okay, throw it away. Is this better than what I have? And it just goes on and on and on. It's like, how about when you give me new armor, it's good?
And
how
you
about
know what?
That?
That's the model that, even more so than Mass Effect, that Dragon Age was following, where it was like every enemy you killed gave you another fucking helmet.
I can't stand that. It just pissed me off in Too Human. It pissed me off in Mass Effect. It pisses me off in Torchlight. It's like, this is not playing the game. This is just like busy work to deal with all. And they always give you real limited inventory. So at some point, you can no longer ignore it.
Yeah. So it was like, well, now I've got 18 leather helmets instead of 17.
But Mass Effect 2 fixes that problem, doesn't it?
It does, but it makes the game feel basically like a third-person shooter with story. Like, I'm
cool with that.
I don't even want to put the RPG label on this game, to be honest, because, I mean, it's kind of its own thing. It's not really...
I would have thought you might be grateful for that under the circumstances.
So yeah. Don't, you know?
I know, I'm just saying, that's the label it wears, and I'm not sure it's really a fair one.
No, James, we need to move on from the BioWare stuff, but before we do, I want to ask real quick, have you ever played or do you have any interest in the Sonic RPG that BioWare made for DS?
I have not played it, and my interest is pretty fleeting because the Sonic franchise has a litany of just terrible characters that should have never been created.
Well, someone asked me about it this week, and I said, you know, I haven't played it beyond an E3 demo. I really don't have much interest, but I thought maybe you did.
It's okay.
Since you've become quite the fanboy of this developer, apparently. And that's, I was just thinking, it's just a shame that BioWare doesn't really make stuff for Nintendo, but there is that one game for DS.
Yeah, that one bizarro game.
It's pretty good. It's kind of simple. The story is kind of silly. I mean, there are a lot of silly characters in there, but it's not too bad.
They are, as a company, very good at writing humor.
Yeah.
Which is something that is sorely missing from gaming, to be honest.
Yeah, it's very hard to do. Okay, so we need to move on. John, which one do you want to start with here?
I'll start off with Torchlight. That should be fairly quick. Yeah, this is kind of like a leftover from, I think, Amazon or Steam. They had a big sale on, and I got Torchlight for like $5 or something like that. But
wow, it's 20 now on Steam.
I got it for some. I couldn't pass it up because it was. And actually, I think that day it actually dropped down to like $3 or something like that. So I could have gotten it even cheaper.
Good grief. It's well worth that.
Oh, it's yeah, it's really
even
good.
If you barely play it, it's well worth that.
Yeah. So this is kind of like an isometric RPG, pretty much I think it was done by the Diablo guys that, you know, and it's very much like that game.
Yeah, they were like thrice removed from Blizzard, but yeah, it's a Diablo clone, basically.
Yep, like Johnny said, it's a gear fest. I mean, it's loot whores will love
That's
it.
That's the only part about it I don't like. I like everything else about Torchlight.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's just really tightly designed. I mean, it's one of those games that does sort of one thing and it just does it well. I mean, you know exactly what you're going to get going in. You fight monsters, get loot, and you do quests. There's like kind of like a hub town, and then you descend down into the depths of the mine. The whole thing is kind of centered around there's this ore called Ember, I think it is, and it's being mined in the depths of you know, just outside of this town called Torchlight, and I haven't really gotten too far into it. I've got about maybe an hour or two into it, but yeah, I mean, really, really impressive art direction in it.
Have you listened to the music?
Yeah, the music is really good.
It is.
And looks really good. It reminds me a lot of a console game, which brings me to the point, like, I really don't understand why it hasn't been ported to Wii. It's on PC, and I think they're coming out with one for Mac. The thing is, it's entirely mouse-driven. The combat is mouse-driven, moving around. You click on a spot on the ground, and you move to it, you click on an enemy and you fight it, and that's pretty much it. You can bind certain things to keys, like if, you know, like your health potion, you can bind that to like number one or number two or whatever like that, but that's as complex as it gets. So I can't think of a PC game that would be more easily ported to Wii than Torchlight. So
yeah, you're right. It would be great. And the other thing is, I mean, it already has a netbook.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's got netbook compatibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have super high system requirements. So it seems like the engine that they've built, you know, maybe it could be made to run on the Wii hardware without too much trouble. I just wonder if it's maybe a distribution issue. It's a very, very small company that put it out there, and maybe they just don't have the means to break into a Wii retail space. And the game, I don't think it would work as WiiWare. I think you would have to put it on
big.
A disc.
But yeah, I mean, if you can find it, I mean, even if you can't find it cheap, it's well worth your money. I mean, it's an excellent game. It's actually much better than I thought it would be.
I think I paid $20 or $25 for it, and I've never even I've never even really played Diablo kind of games before, but I've enjoyed it. I play it just little by little. Whenever I'm kind of, you know, on a plane or something like that, and I have an hour with my netbook and nothing else to do, then that's what I do.
Yeah. So I highly recommend that. The other game, of course, I'm playing, still playing, Disaster Day of Crisis. And I decided I was...
Disaster update. Is your non-existent hair being blown in the breeze as you will report from the scene of the disaster?
We need a jingle.
Yeah, I think
disaster update!
So I started playing it because the last thing I had played was, I was right at the point where, you know, you got into like the gunplay, you go into this warehouse. And it was interesting. The gunplay is actually interesting because I thought it would be more freeform. But it's actually more like Time
like
Crisis.
Like interpretive dance? Freeform?
It's very much like Time Crisis. That's what I said about
yeah.
it.
Does it at least have like a cover mechanic like Time Crisis?
Yeah, it does. I believe you hit B and you can kind of stick to a wall.
Can you put a controller on the floor and step on it with your foot?
No, you can't. But I wish you could.
In the PlayStation 1 or PlayStation 2 versions of Time Crisis, you could put a second controller on the floor and mash it with your foot to emulate that big pedal in the arcade.
Oh,
that's awesome.
It's just so unnecessary. I thought that was very interesting, and you know, the other thing I'm taking away from it is like, oh my god, does it beat you over the head with tutorials? I mean, it is constant. I mean, I've played only a couple of hours of it, and I've already gone through 25 tutorials because you can actually go and because it unlocks them, you can go back to the main screen and view the ones because you know you want to look at them again and again and again. And I counted them all, and I was like, my god, that's a huge list, and sure enough. 25 tutorials. I mean, what they do is when you come to something new, which, I mean, really, the game is not that complex. I have no idea why they have to keep showing you tutorials all the time. They'll stop everything, show you the screen explaining everything, which, of course, I can't read because it's all in Japanese, so which makes it even better, makes the experience even better. And then they kind of like place you such that you can practice it.
Not that you know what you're practicing.
Exactly. No idea what's going on at that point. And then it actually places you back into the game proper and you actually complete the area that you're in. So, and this happens, you know, repeat that about 25 times, probably even more as the game goes on. And it just gets ridiculous after a while.
My time with it was very dominated by tutorials, you know what? So I think it was probably just getting to the point where the tutorials were going to subside.
Well, the funny thing is, all the tutorials really boil down to shake the remote.
Yeah. And oh my god, I mean the
fucking waggle.
It's
right?
Just the waggle is so heavy-handed.
Helping people up from an edge, giving people resuscitation. Oh, I love those.
I mean, yeah, literally every single thing you do in that game requires you to shake the nunchuck or something. Just every single thing in that game. I mean, it gets to the point where you're sitting there just waiting for it. Like, oh my god, what am I gonna have to do for this? It's like because you know if there's something you have to run from, you're gonna be doing the Wii Sports bike style pumping with the two controllers. And it gets so predictable after a while, you're just like, oh my god, what kind of waggle fest are they gonna have me doing now? Like the funniest one that I've come across so far is I think you're actually going up the back of the warehouse, up a fire escape, and you're trying to find a door that's open, so you have to go to every door. And of course, to open up the door, you have to turn your Wii remote like a doorknob. And I'm like, really? Really? You couldn't have just mapped that to the A button? You have to force me to do that every time.
Well, to be fair, Metroid Prime 3 does some of that shit too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not every door. Usually you just point and shoot at the door.
I know, but still, it is there.
And it makes sense too, because you're actually kind of trying to put stick in a key and unlock something. But this is just, I mean, it's waggle for the sake of waggle. And so, I mean, that's I think one of the biggest kind of downfalls of the game is it's just they felt, I don't know who told them to do that, but it's just way too much.
So, John, are you coming around to Reggie's point of view on Disaster, which is that it's not really worth bringing to America?
I think so. I mean, what surprises me though is that it's not bad. It's not a bad game. It's just I think that they tried too hard to make it unique. Way too hard. And but what surprises me is why Nintendo just didn't let somebody else publish it and take a bath on it, you know? Like, what does Nintendo care?
Well, maybe that's just it. Maybe nobody came forward and said, I'll publish this game.
Yeah, I guess. I suppose they looked at it like, if Nintendo doesn't want it, why would I want it?
Because I think, as I said before, there's a time sensitivity element to this game. Mm-hmm. I think it needed to come out relatively close to the system's launch to be acceptable. And even by the time it was finished to go out in Japan, where it was published, I think it was a bit dated. And then by the time America would be in a position to relinquish its options on it, it certainly would have been far too late in the day, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, one of the weird things about Nintendo is that I can think of, right now I can't think of any examples of when they've allowed another company to publish one of their games.
Cubivore.
There's probably an example.
Cubivore.
Cubivore is a good example, James. I'm pretty sure Nintendo published that in Japan, and you're right, Atlas ended up publishing it in America. So that's probably an exception. That kind of thing is extremely rare.
Yeah, that game, I remember, because it was kind of infamous because that happened.
Yeah, and I think everyone was surprised that Cubivore came out in America at all.
Because it's such a screwed up game to begin with.
Oh, dude. I have it in, I have the Japanese version, and I cannot imagine that it makes any more sense in English.
Well, I mean, I've never seen a game where the quote on the box is, nothing positive, it's just one of the most bizarre video games ever created, IGN.
I wrote that quote.
Really? Because IGN's credited for it.
Okay, no. I wrote what was the one I wrote? It's something like,
I'm the only person that has played this game, Johnny Metz.
I think my quote might be in the magazine ads that they were running or something. I don't know. I'd have to go. I'm sorry. I don't have my review pulled up right now. I'd have to go through it and figure it out.
Sorry, it's framed. I can't take it down off the wall.
Was it a similar kind of opinion, though?
Yes, it was very, very, very similar to that quote from IGN.
I guess that was their angle. To be honest, I think you're better off playing up that angle rather than trying to convince people.
Oh, yeah, because the game itself is just like,
Hey, no, honestly, I really highly recommend that people play Cubivore. I think it is totally bizarre and hilarious, maybe in some of the same ways that Disaster is, but I think Cubivore is actually kind of a good game. I mean, it's good enough that it's worth playing through for all the other
It's got a little bit of Viva Pinata. It's got a little bit of that in there.
It does.
Which is another weird ass game.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But it looks like a Picasso painting in 3D.
Yeah, it does.
It's totally crazy looking, and it's actually really cute, really funny, and I think it actually plays pretty well. I think Cubivore is a good game. If you ever see a copy of it, you should grab it.
Maybe that should be one of our retro games.
Well, I've still got my Japanese copy, I think. So I'm down. That's a game I used to show. I used to like bust it out and show it to people all the time because it's hilarious, you know.
Yeah.
It's like Katamari Damacy. It's something that people like to sit around and laugh at. Okay, Greg, please wrap up this epic new business.
As well, this one should be comparatively brief and unrelated to RPGs or companies that make them.
How dare you, sir?
I'm sick
this
of RPGs.
This just came out last week to coincide with the release of the DSi XL in Europe, a Picross 3D, which I think I talked about playing the demo of this on the Japanese Nintendo channel about 10 months ago.
Yeah.
Because it did come out a long time ago in Japan, and obviously extensive localization was required for the numbers in the game. And here we are, and it's another couple of months yet until it comes out in America.
Yes.
It's rather strange, but... Yeah, it's I never felt, obviously, DS games are region free. I buy a lot of my games from abroad, but I didn't feel compelled to pay the import premium on it because it's...
Nah.
I really did enjoy the original Picross DS, but I felt there's a very appropriate sort of price point for it, and when it came out here last week, it was much closer to the mark.
It's still right. Picross, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing with Picross, I mean, it's wonderful as a handheld sort of time killer. You know, it's very appropriate, I think, for me if I'm playing on the train or whatever, I'm half asleep. You know, it's much more fitting than, you know, Contra 4 or Hatsworth.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, you do have to use your brain, you do have to pay attention, but it's not Twitch or anything like that. And as I've said about Picross before, I think, you know, the funny thing about it is really all it is executing an algorithm. You're just eliminating, you know, there isn't any... It's not a puzzle, like a creative solving sort of thing that you might get in like an adventure game, you know, like a Zakamiki or a Zelda or anything like that.
Right. It's the kind of thing where you could write a computer program to solve every puzzle.
You could,
ever
yes.
made. Like Sudoku.
Yeah, it exists. Much like Sudoku, you know, and it's not the sort of tricky logic puzzle of something like Layton or, you know, any of that kind of stuff either. So it's very straightforward. That's the point, really. It's all there for you. But sometimes it can be surprisingly sort of difficult to actually see it there. And the 3D angle does definitely play that up because it's not as transparent. You know, all the information isn't sort of accessible to your eyes straight off the bat. A fair bit of the game there is kind of manipulating the camera. So that's handled relatively well from the point of view, like you have these little sliders, or I think they call them slicers actually, but... where you could kind of proceed Spacer. Through the block of cubes to look at each individual set of columns and rows.
Hmm.
So you could kind of do it one 2D plane at a time through the cube of blocks. Look at each cross section, and that's pretty much how you tend to sort of, you know, once you kind of get the hang of it, you start to proceed through it quite mechanically, really. But I think the fact that you have got this 3D element to it, you know, it's not something that you could have on pen and paper or in a newspaper or whatever, that means that it feels a bit more like a video game. It does kind of add a bit more dressing to the, you know, very mathematical nature of it, and so it does make it a little more sort of fun. I think it appeals to a certain kind of person that has those, you know, obsessive compulsive kind of tendencies to just solve and eliminate.
Yeah.
And, you know, and like I said, in the very particular circumstances with a handheld, it's just a, you know, pretty surprisingly addictive way to kill some time. And I do like the 3D element. I'm not sure whether it'll ever get... I mean, I've only... Like, they split the puzzles into, like, easy, normal, and hard. But you do have to progress through. You can't, like, pick from a menu. You begin with easy, and I've, like, done, like, the first... I think they say there's over 350 puzzles in the game. With many more... There's DLC. You can make them yourselves and trade it with your friends. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to keep you busy.
Are you saying that you have to play all the easy puzzles before you can play any of the normal?
Yes, but here's the interesting thing, is that I think in some ways the classifications are a bit of a misnomer from the point of view that having just cracked the normal tier, the first few ones on normal are much less complicated than the latter ones on easy. If you know what I mean, like, you know, once you got to the end of easy, you had some really quite large formations to work with and, you know, lots of information to have to process. Whereas then when you come to the start of normal, you're back to maybe, you know, the block is only, you know, two cubes deep or something. So, but I think what it is the numerical sequencing is trickier on normal.
So it dials it back down to introduce you to the new kind of...
Yeah, the new ones where, like, so say, for instance, you know, obviously it's a lot easier when the rows have a lot of things filled in, because yeah. It's like, right, I can fill those in straight away. I think what you do with normal is now you're going to have less of that, but you start back with simpler formations and then you're going to work up again. So it's not quite as much of a linear sort of thing as that makes it sound. So I guess it makes it life worse for reviewers that might have liked to sample what these different tiers are like without having to solve hundreds of puzzles to see it. But for the average person, I don't really think it's a big problem.
Oh, that sounds great. I'm actually really looking forward to it, and I plan on picking it up in May, I guess, when it comes out in the
US. I think it is. I mean, the other thing I would say about it is you do get these nice little animations once you solve it. If you solve it with, I think you have to do it within a certain length of time to actually do that. And also another difference, actually, quite a big difference with the original Picross is that you're kind of chiseling away at this block formation when you eliminate something in your mind. You know, you can elect to destroy it. But if you destroy something you shouldn't have done, it just tells you you got it wrong. And that's like, I think you've got like up to 5 mistakes, and then I guess it would fail you out. With Picross DS, or at least certainly in the latter stages of Picross DS, it was like you could fill things in and it would be wrong, but you wouldn't know that.
So your error becomes propagated throughout the whole puzzle.
And then eventually the impossibility of what you're presented with would become apparent to you, and you're like, oh, crap, how many minutes ago did that go wrong?
Right.
So it kind of eliminates that, which I guess makes it easier. Maybe they just didn't want to get into that, into 3D, you know, in this 3D realm, like, you know, sort of people going wrong in that way. So it's kind of a bit more upfront. But you get rewards for completing a puzzle like with a 3-star rating, which is in enough time with no mistakes, you can unlock extra puzzles and stuff. So it kind of incentivizes you to do well, but it doesn't really punish you for messing it up within reason. But you get these nice little animations for when you solve it, which are pretty funny. I mean, the thing is, in many ways, they kind of need these to actually sell the fact that this fairly indeterminate sort of group of blocks is what they say it is, but they are quite funny. Even for nice little animations for inanimate objects, funnily enough, they are quite cute and charming. So it's you get your reward at the end for your furious number crunching.
Awesome. Okay, well, it's the end of the segment here. We're gonna have to take a break, and I'm gonna have to duck out of here, and I'll tell you why. I'm actually going to see Jason Ricci and New Blood play a concert tonight, and that's why we actually were recording a little bit early so I can get out of here and drive down to the show. And those of you who have started listening to the show recently may not know who I'm talking about, but Jason is the guy you hear playing at the beginning and the end of the show and during the breaks also. He's a friend of mine, and he has given us permission to use his music on our podcast. So I'm going down there to shake his hand, tell him thanks, and enjoy a full concert. And I would highly recommend that you do the same next time he comes through your area. So look online, and I think there are actually links in the podcast articles where you can go and get some more information about that. But you really should sometime. It's a great band, and he's a supporter of this show. So return the favor if you ever get a chance. I'm going to do that now. Greg will be in charge when you get back, and I guess the gang is going to kill some stuff. So look forward to it.
Calm down, kiddies.
And I will see you next week. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week on NintendoWorldReport.com, we have a GDC retrospective, actually a couple of different features that Aaron Kaluska did from last year's GDC. Really interesting stuff. There's seminars on the development of Nintendo DSi, myths surrounding Wii's online functionality, and some interesting stuff about the future of, well, at least it was the future back then, mm-hmm. of input devices on Nintendo systems. So definitely check those out to get you in the spirit for our current GDC coverage, which has already kicked off at the time we're recording with a kind of undercover, I think, video footage of BitTrip Runner. Ooh. And there will be a lot more along those lines coming out.
We also have a whole slate of reviews this week. To kick it off, we have Zach's take on Nick's Quest Kindred Spirits for WiiWare. He said that it has beautiful graphics and kind of Kirby-style flight controls, but it also has some frustrating checkpoints and a weak ending.
There were no dinosaurs in the ending, so it was upsetting.
Of course.
Nick's Quest is one of my favorite WiiWare games of last year.
Yeah. All right. And also, Matt Blunden gives us a review of Hubert the Teddy Bear Winter Games.
Yes!
For WiiWare.
So, game of the year.
Is this like a two game pack?
Johnny, you go skiing enough, don't you see teddy bears out there?
I don't hang out in those trees, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay, and Matt's take on it was that it's probably good for the young crowd that it's aimed at, but its winter-themed mini-games are too repetitive for older gamers like Johnny, who probably already owns it.
So we have two reviews for Sonic Sega All-Star Racing. For the DS, Matt writes that its unoriginal items and uninspired track make it a Mario Kart clone that's just not there.
That's too bad. I've heard a lot of good things about the console versions.
Well, speaking of the console version...
Beautiful segue. That's exactly what I wanted.
Neil has a review of the Wii one, which he said the online mode is good, and he calls it a worthy alternative to Mario Kart.
Let's close out the review lineup. Zach travels back in time to give us a look at Retro Game Challenge, which says there's some filler and it's a bit sloppy in its execution, but the niche audience that this title caters to will really like it.
Is that a retro review now?
Yes, it's a retro review of Zach is our official reviewer of games that are 6 to 12 months old.
And we have an interview with Sabarasa. We talked to Javier Otogwe at Sabarasa about their upcoming DSiWare game Save the Turtles, and also chat about the game development scene in Latin America.
There's a lot going on down there, so check out that interview and all this other great coverage at NintendoWorldReport.com.
And we are back without the services of Johnny Metz, unfortunately. But for the beginning of this segment, we're going to start with a little feature that John actually had the idea for, being the bloodthirsty fella that he is.
Absolutely.
Obviously, the number of the episode making it fitting that these are some of the things in the gaming industry that we want to die. Mm-hmm. In fact, Johnny thinks he's going to a Jason Ricci and New Blood concert tonight, but tune in next week to find out whether he actually was.
Yeah, let's see if he makes it. You know, maybe he'll play his final tune. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe Jason Ricci's in California tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's all kinds of ways somebody could disappear. Maybe wind up in a car trunk. Whatever.
But we will start with the things that we want to be killed off.
That aren't Jonathan Metz.
With James, who you know, is well known for his tolerant stance on many things. I'm sure this will be difficult.
I'm a tolerant individual who loves everybody, except people who continue to make Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games. So not the games themselves, but the people who make them.
Specifically Chunsoft?
Yes.
I think you would be better off specifying the games themselves here, because I do feel that Chunsoft are quite replaceable in this role.
Yeah, they are. What it really is the concept of the lazy Pokemon game.
The lazy Pokemon spin-off or even the lazy versions of the mainline games.
I can deal with the mainline games because at least some work has to go into those. I feel like the Mystery Dungeon, and we were discussing Ranger earlier, but I'm not familiar enough with the series to say if that's the case. Maybe those need to stop, because honestly, I looked at Explorers of the Sky, which is the newest one, mm-hmm. and if you told me it came from the game I played for 20 hours, I would have believed you immediately. Because it looks just the same.
Well, I assume it's pretty much just a character pack, right?
There's some new Pokemon, because we can't squeeze them all on here anyway. But there's no new ones in there. I mean, they were all existing at the time of creation, as it were.
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you feel about spin-offs in general, in terms of their worthiness?
Generally speaking, I'm not a fan of them. However, I have to put the caveat there, because I own 4 Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicle games. So it's kind mm-hmm. of unfair for me, because there's something I'd want to die. I want the constant confusion of what the hell the Crystal Chronicles franchise means. To be killed, because I don't know
it's
anymore.
Tower defense, whatever they want it to be.
Like, there's not even a consistent mythology. It's just whatever. Screw it. Let's go.
So perhaps we could put an umbrella over this in terms of brand dilution.
Yeah, like Guitar Hero.
That's certainly a different kind of thing, because you're looking at, you were looking at a situation there where obviously all the games they're putting out, they're not, in random other genres or very tenuously linked to the sort of core of the series, but you're talking about not just annualizable, but
right.
Very multiple SKUs per year. So it certainly is equally or more of a dilution of the power of the brand, really, but just in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the Mario case?
That's kind of moved into almost just like, I want there to be more spin-offs, because now it's just funny.
Yeah.
Like, if we could have, Grand Theft Auto Mario Edition, I'd shit myself. I'd be thrilled. but we've basically, can you name a genre there hasn't been a Mario spinoff in? First-person shooter.
No,
that's
I say old-school side-scrolling shooter, although I guess parts of Mario Land were like that.
A little bit, yeah. That's reached sort of, the critical mass of spinoffs, where you're just like, well, what defines a spinoff now?
Well, I think they do a better job of at least injecting certain Mario elements into a lot of the spin-offs that make it feel like a spin-off rather than just a label, you're talking about some of the sports games and, powers, or I guess with Mario Kart, it started off a lot more Mario-ish, with the coins and all that sort of thing, the hopping with the power sliding, all that kind of thing. It felt like it was working a lot harder to make you think that this was really associated with Mario, whereas Mario Kart has its own identity now, so they don't feel quite so much like they have to do that.
The one series that I thought was kind of straying into the area of just slapping a name on random games was Metroid. When they kind of went and did the Metroid Prime Hunters, and then they did the Metroid Prime Pinball, I was like...
Pinball is canon.
I was like...
It is, because it's just Metroid Prime. It's just Metroid Prime in pinball form. It's just the parallel world where she did it all in the ball and never got out.
Yes, with big giant flat flippers.
You're bought and sold, Greg. Bought and sold.
It's well, at least that was good. I will say that.
I feel like that you can't say that brand has just been slapping itself on everything, because there's only been 12 games
the thing
total.
Is, those were the only DS games that Metroid's ever had.
Yeah. I'm just saying at one point I thought, I was kind of wondering about it. I was like,
yeah,
what are
well,
they really
that's
doing
it
here?
Did seem like they were gearing up, and then it's like, how about we don't?
Yeah. Then they realize that it's Metroid and they have to put it back on a shelf in a corner.
Yeah, all right, you get lost.
Well, we talked about brand dilution there. It's not bad. It's definitely not going to die.
Mm-mm.
No.
I don't think Pokemon spin-offs in specific are going to die anytime soon, considering how very, very successful.
Can we just go back to just Chunsoft in general?
But they make other games. Who's going to make the... you're killing Chocobo Mystery Dungeon as well, James.
Good!
Are you ready to accept responsibility for that?
Do you remember Nick's review of that?
Well, anyway, we've talked about that. John, I want your next thing that needs to go.
The next thing that needs to go are game analysts. These guys that come in from, whatever, Lazard or whatever.
You're telling me you don't watch Pack Attack on game trailers every week, John? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, the reason why these guys have to go, in my opinion, is because...
Because they totally whiffed on the Wii?
Well, I mean, completely whiffed on the Wii, but the thing is they continue. What kills me is that they continue to whiff on the Wii in the sense that, every single year it's like... Pretty much the Wii has peaked, and it's going to go downhill, and the PS3 is going to rise to prominence.
Heaven. It's going to rise to heaven.
Yeah.
That was the DS.
it's like they aren't even predicting anything now. They're just basically sitting there saying the same thing every year almost trying to like will it to happen.
Well, they own a lot of Sony stock. You got to understand, Sony took a major bath on this stuff.
Yeah.
their hedge funds are full of it.
Yeah. I suppose I think the most pressing argument I can make in favor of this is just the fact that when you tend to see these sorts of things, they don't necessarily make the most compelling arguments for it in terms of laying out the reasoning. These are analysts. We are left with who they have data, and you know they're just observing broader trends, or they
yeah,
hear things from other
people.
You'd like some sort of a distillation of that basis for their reasoning as to why they're predicting what they're predicting, but usually what you get is a sort of a list of assertions, as you illustrated with the, oh well, it's peaked, or it's like, well, I'm sure it probably has peaked, but it's still been outselling the others in the post peak, which mm-hmm. makes it rather difficult to catch up.
You know, I work with analysts, and everything you just suggested is wrong.
Fair enough.
they might have data, but they just say fuck it, I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, feel it in your water, get the dividing rods out.
Well, I just think it's so funny because every single year it's like, oh, this is going to be the year that PS3 overtakes everything. No, this is going to be the year where it does that. No, hold on a second. I was totally wrong those other last 2 years. This is going to be the year where the PS3 overtakes everything.
Well, I think what's really interesting at this point is the fact with this sort of thing, predicting that the PS3, for instance, would outsell everything over the life.
Yeah, you still hear that. That was actually just reported yesterday by somebody.
Well, it was, but the problem is that to do that, you have to predict the life cycle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What is the life cycle?
Or even, perhaps, before you predict it, define it, which is probably going to be rather trickier than it has been in the past with the Natal and the PlayStation Move.
Yes.
Now that they're calling it, you know. So, again, I want to see the basis of that. You know, when you say, well, we're assuming that the PS3 is basically going to be this, and, you know, the Wii would be replaced this year, and to be swayed by an argument, I at least want to see it laid out, its foundations.
I mean,
and that's and presumably, as you said, if the analysts, their job is actually not to pull it out of the air,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it shouldn't be so difficult to show your workings, as it were, and yet seldom do we see this however often they're given slots on game trailers or whatever.
To be honest, I mean, at the current going rate, like, I'm trying to remember what it was. Somebody did the math and said if the PS3 sold at its current rate and the Wii just stopped selling, like, no other Wii was ever sold ever again, it would take, like, 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that claim now is becoming increasingly insane.
Yeah, that's why it still amazes me that you still see people saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea of someone bringing some corporate market expertise to mm-hmm. the industry. My problem is we don't see it. I'm not seeing the inside. You know, we're supposed to get the inside scoop on what's really going on, you know, at the top level.
Yeah, it's just in all of these things, I just see like some kind of sales jargon thrown around, like, oh yeah, based upon what we see that Nintendo has in the channel, you know, blah blah blah.
Nobody
and it's
knows
like I'm supposed to like take that as, you know, some manna from the heavens.
Nobody knows what they have in the channel, which is why that's so ridiculous, because the channel is like sealed in with concrete, like it's got nuclear waste inside. Nobody's getting in.
Well, I don't think it's a bad choice. My first one is going to be very off the broader industry issue. So this is like a very minor complaint, really. But I still think, you know, it has to go. And this is something I've experienced mostly from playing the HD console games, the PS3 games that I've played. It's what I will refer to it probably somewhat inaccurately as random enemy babble. James mentioned this with respect to Avatar on the Wii. So often now, it just
we're gonna destroy everything.
So often now, it's just like, okay, so you've got voice work in the game. It's like, oh, you've got all these enemy characters, and just, you know, there's loads of them. They're a dime a dozen. They come along all the time. But it seems, especially with PS3, as James said, with certain games on Wii as well, it's just like they have to say things, and they just have these awfully delivered canned things that they just hear again and again and again, and it's just so irksome. It's like, I appreciate that you're trying to, you know, make the world feel more alive, or, you know, give more personality to these sort of bog standard enemies or whatever. It just doesn't work. I mean, you know, you are intending people to play these games for several hours.
Yeah.
So you must know that this isn't going to hold up for very long.
I mean, the only place where I've seen that done well is Grand Theft Auto 4, really.
Right.
And the thing is that did so well that everybody just went overboard on it.
I mean, what I've seen, like Ratchet Clank, Bioshock, which I've been playing through recently, Killzone 2, naturally, they're just so damn chatty, all these enemies.
Yep.
And I'm really quite sick of what they've had to say after
I'm going to kill you, human. Just random stuff. It's like, no, really? No, you're not? Wow, amazing. Of course you're going to kill me, you dumbass. You're the enemy.
I guess it's unnatural in some ways that they would be, you know, perfectly silent while you're trying to kill them or they're trying to kill you or whatever, but it's equally unnatural for 30 people to say the same thing. So let's just choose the thing that's not annoying.
Exactly.
That would be my policy.
Well, it's like play by play in sports games where they say the same phrases over and over again. It's like, you know,
it is a bit.
You really just could leave the play by play out entirely. I wouldn't miss
it. You could, but I could at least see how, you know, you get to that point more with sports games.
Well, you know, it's funny because John mentioned this in sports games, and I have a really good example of that.
John Madden.
Well, no, even worse in
old school Madden. Hey, heck of a play!
Like I bought. I mentioned this on the show a while ago, and I bought, you know, one of the NCAA football games for like $3, and there was a play that the computer just couldn't defend. It was like this play action pass that they fell for every single time. So it had the same commentary every time. One time I was like, I'm going to see how high a score I can get. It was like 200-0. I heard that stupid play call every time I threw the ball. Mm-hmm. And I was like, by the end of it, I was like mouthing it as they said it. This is awful.
That reminds me of, I think it was on the Nintendo 64, Kobe Bryant, his game. Was it NBA Courtside?
That sounds right.
The funniest thing was there was a guy that used to play for the Hawks, Dikembe Mutombo. And it was funny.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so funny because he was one of the few guys. They only had like a few people's names in there. So, you know, so when you would score with them, it would say their names. But the way that the guy said his name was so hilarious. He was like, Dikembe Mutombo. And so if you scored, and the thing is, what you could do with him is you could score, then steal the ball from somebody because his stats were pretty good at the time. So you could score, steal the ball, and then just keep scoring with him. And so he would sit there and it would just be like, Dikembe Mutombo, Dikembe Mutombo. And people in the other room would be like, what in the hell are you playing?
Awful. If you've ever seen the broken pixels about what was that ping pong movie with Christopher Walken, Balls of Fury or something?
Yeah.
It's just like they've got all these canned lines from the movie or whatever, and it just keep repeating, like, tell your grandma to bring the car around. Tell your grandma. If you haven't seen that Broken Pixels, find it. It's hilarious and just awful. And they're a very good argument against this sort of shit in games.
Dikembe Mutombo.
Well, I guess I could offer up another one here. Something else that I think. This is kind of a two-pack. Two things that I think from beloved franchises that need to die. And I kind of talked about these before, but I think bears mentioning again. First of all, the 120 stars structure in 3D Mario. I'm very hopeful it is not going to be in Galaxy 2. We don't really know that for sure yet. There's like some screenshots maybe imply that it isn't, but that needs to go. It's had its day. And also, there's whole Zelda do three things and get the Master Sword.
Oh, yeah.
That needs to go into the Sacred Realm void. Or
well, you know, they've been careful about what they call the Master Sword. Sometimes they don't even call it that, but it still looks like the Master Sword. It's like the hilt shaped a little bit differently.
Yeah, you know, it's just that sort of predictability is a little, you know, I think much more so in Zelda, really, because the thing with Mario is that the structure isn't that important to the game, whereas with Zelda it very much is. And when you can predict, it's like, okay, so this is the forest temple, and then the fire temple, and then the water temple, and then the Master Sword. It's, you know, that's, unless of course they just take it out, or take the water one out, which they did in Wind Waker. I guess that qualifies as a change up. But that really, just that kind of predictability, that kind of procession really takes some of the wonder out of it.
Well, it seems like they're chained to it. Like they're scared. It's become so ingrained as a part of the series now that they're almost scared to change it. It's really weird.
It's part of the awakening of the hero. It's, you know, it's a, because they justify it as each of these heroes are a different hero. So each of them has to go claim this sort of relic of filling that role, and that would be the Master Sword.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's basically saying to be the hero of time, or whatever they call the hero at that particular moment, he has to possess the Master Sword to fully realize his position. It's a relic that belongs to the person who is filling the role of the hero, and therefore he needs to go claim it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is all the more reason why would it kill them to just use a link they've used before? It with Majora's Mask, yeah. And that was great. Whatever story reasons are for it or not for it, just mix it up a bit. And you don't have to go as crazy as Majora's Mask, let's be mm-hmm. honest. You know, I mean, there no. are... of you look at some of the handheld games, they maybe do have a bit of a, you know, more of a different structure and stuff, but you know, the mainline console games, you know, Wind Waker, Twilight Princess, play exactly to that template. And of course Link to the Past did it first, mm-hmm. Before Ocarina followed that, you know, so you're talking about really, you know, the four big Zelda games post the NES era all following this same thing. That has got to change.
Well, you know, I mean...
And perhaps, and not just change, but perhaps never come back, which is why it's in this category of being killed off.
Well, I mean, they could still give you the Master Sword, just do it a different way.
Yeah, just not Earth, Fire, Water. Just mix up the order, dude.
Just be like, just maybe somebody just acknowledges his position and gives it to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't need to go Lady of the Lake here and have somebody throw it at him, but he could just be like, I think you're filling this role. Here, take it.
I just wish that they would just be a lot less conservative with the way they design every game. I mean, it's to the point now where...
we're blowing this up now.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, every game in that series, like, it just gets so... Okay, it's like you pretty much know exactly how the game is going to unfold before you even start playing.
Yeah, usually, you know, there's some... turning point in the middle associated with the Master Sword. Then yep. after that, there's going to be more dungeons, and then the conclusion mm-hmm. will follow, involving a showdown with Ganondorf. I really think you've done that, and that should be the end of that. So that's another one of my sections. So James, have you got something for me?
Yeah. So one of the things that I would really really like to see get rid of is the unskippable tutorial. Maybe not for games that are the first in the series, or even the first on this console, but how about if you've got another game save from the previous title in this series...
You can might not skip. Be referring to Tails here, might you?
Well, no, because that's on the GameCube. Well, no, that's too true, because I loaded my save over. But that game is significantly different enough that maybe you didn't need to. But I know I'm going to have to play a tutorial on Mario Galaxy 2. I already beat Mario Galaxy. I know how your cash-in game plays.
Yep.
I don't know. They were good about it with New Super Mario Bros. Wii and all that kind of stuff.
But
obviously, it's a less complicated
much
game.
Much to explain.
Also, I'd say, like, Mario & Luigi 3, for instance, like Bowser's Inside Story, that has, you know, all sorts of, like, explanatory stuff about, you know, the basics, the real basics, but it always offers you the chance to skip. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's part of Nintendo's kind of whole approach to these sorts of things, especially because it's Galaxy 2. I mean, it's literally Galaxy 2. It's coming out 2.5 years later. And Miyamoto's even said, you know, that this game is very much going to be aimed at people that played the first one, you know, and they're ready for it again, you know, more complicated, all this kind of stuff. It doesn't really sound like it's trying to reach out to the new people so much, so I think it would be decidedly incongruous of them to then put in unskippable tutorials. So if that happens, you have every right to complain very vociferously about that. But I mean, in general, I think it's a solid point, because you know, with a lot of game series, a fairly significant portion of the audience that's buying it has played a game similar to it before. And I'm sure at least you can put some sort of modicum of streamlining, so certain parts, so you can kind of, it's how you kind of set up the tutorial in terms of separating the bits that would be completely familiar with the bits that are actually additional to previous games. So I think it's a perfectly reasonable request that they should go away. Have you got any more good hardcore offenders in that category? I'm trying to think.
Well, sports games are better about it. How about racing games? There's no need for a tutorial.
Yeah, really.
Press A, go. Like, yeah. Like maybe an optional tutorial, but not one that I have that I see by default.
A to accelerate, B to brake. Thanks.
It's actually got the letters in the name.
Mm-hmm. You can't get much easier than that. I mean, maybe you drive into some pits. Maybe.
What some of the problem is, and this is where you get a real issue, is where they weave tutorial aspects into the narrative.
And you'd have to work about that. I mean, you'd have to say, well, we can't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, this is the point, isn't it? You know, so it's like, okay, we're trying to make it so it's more organic in a way. You know, it's not just like, let's explain this to you really, you know, boldly. And so we're going to weave it into the story. But of course, by doing so, it really, you really couldn't skip it. And so then you've got two examples come to mind. Twilight Princess, the whole sequence in Ordon, is it? Where you like with the kids attacking the Scarecrow and, you know, that is a problem. And then I reviewed the second Pokemon Ranger game, mm-hmm. of its Shadows of Olmia, where you've got this whole extremely long tutorial sequence built into this sort of idea that you're going through Ranger school before you actually set out on the game. And it is so interminable to sit through all that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how you could just put a skip button in there without, you know, going through all this exposition, but the result is just 2 hours of absolute tedium. Mm-hmm. So don't do it unless you really mean it.
Yeah. Like that.
John?
Yeah, one of my biggest pet peeves is the mixing of business with my video gaming. I am so sick of hearing terms like Blue Ocean, Red Ocean.
Red Ocean? What is that? I've never even heard that term.
It was a cheap knockoff with the non-union equivalents of Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington.
There you go.
But yeah, it's like I think partly because of kind of like the rise of the internet, there's a lot more sales information floating around and all that kind of stuff. And so I just feel like so much of talk about video games is about so much about the game industry and so much about sales. And
but is it the jargon in particular?
Yeah, I would say really it is the jargon, because you know what? I just feel like a lot of people toss around the phrase Blue Ocean when they never even heard it before. It was like in some Iwata asks. And there are so many armchair, like, Harvard business students now. It just drives me up the wall.
Well,
there's more talk about, like, fucking sales curves than there are about actual video games. It drives me crazy.
So that's the thing. But is the jargon really the sort of the cherry on the cake? And it's more the focus on that aspect in the discourse.
Yeah.
I just find it all distasteful,
Greg, frankly.
Like your primary concern is more that the discussion has shifted more towards the back end, the business. Well, I mean, first off, we more than anybody should be more aware of this. So, mm-hmm. I mean, as part of the responsibility, we do have to keep track of at least that to an extent.
Well, I think I think there's nothing wrong with taking a look at, you know, the trends in the industry and all that, but I think where it's a problem is where it gets co-opted into the hardware wars crap.
Yeah,
that's where you've got a problem, where you're borrowing these terms or you're cherry picking facts, mm-hmm. to support some sort of narrative that, you know, the console that you like the best is the best, or it will, you know, ultimately sell the best, or if it's the Wii, it is selling the best, or whatever, you know. That sort of, it's just a furtherance of a very pointless activity, really.
Yeah.
But it's sort of dressing itself up as something more than it is, which is just this sort of infantile pissing match.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of what, I mean, really at the root, what I get tired of is the sometimes incredibly vicious, I wouldn't even call it fanboyism, it's more factionalism.
Zealotry.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you can't even come on and say, like, if you're on some PS3 board, right? If somebody comes on and says, hey, I really like this Wii game, inevitably you have 15 people coming on and say, whoa, the Wii sucks, and let me tell you all about it.
Well, to be fair, if at the same time, if you had gone back and said, hey, guys, let's talk about Lair, you'd have gotten the same response. It's kind of like this ultra-defensivism or this ultra-aggressivism, depending on the current position of your console of choice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of all about, you know, kind of appreciating. I mean, I obviously own every single console under the sun, so.
And play none of them.
Yeah, I play none of them. So, you know, I just kind of appreciate games of all shapes, colors, sizes, platforms, prices, especially prices.
Appreciate from your shelf.
It is just one of these things that's very unfortunate. I mean, I suppose it exists in all forms of entertainment, I guess, but I don't know. If it does seem to be a particularly strong tradition of it with games. And I think one of the most surprising things to me is just that how it hasn't subsided.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that it would get better, if you like, and it would actually.
You and your faith in humanity, Greg.
I think it was just the fact is that, you know, when the people that grew up with, you know, Nintendo and Sega and all that, they grew up.
Yeah.
So
no,
I would,
they
and
didn't,
a lot
though,
of those people because... are still active gamers today.
Well, the problem is that middle schoolers are still dumbasses.
No, but the point is there are now a lesser percentage of the game playing public. Because the point is, going back, the media, what gaming media there was very different before you had online and all that kind of stuff. But the print magazines, certainly that you got in Britain, were quite juvenile. Mm-hmm. And they would play up to this sort of nonsense because that was the audience. That's what they were, was you know, kids and young people. And, you know, that's what they wanted to hear. They wanted to have the fires fanned and all that kind of stuff. Whereas now, there's so much information out there at your fingertips that's not just, you know, ridiculous, that, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, no matter what.
Because of that,
are.
I think it's even worse.
Yeah, well...
because people just have more ammo.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the Lair example, and I mentioned it because the PS3 had a particularly crappy launch, because how long did it go before it had a killer app? Like a year?
I don't know.
More than a year?
Some people might say it's never had one.
I mean, it's kind of a weird case study in that, but Lair was kind of one of the titles that they put a lot of faith in, and then it was shit.
Yeah.
And then the developers had a hissy fit because people called it shit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back in the day, there would have been no gaming blogs to tell us that developer of Lair sent a 40-page instruction manual on how to play their shitty game. We wouldn't have known this. And there certainly would have been no forums in which to go in there and troll PS3 fans and be like, man, how's that 40-page forum going about your unplayable game?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wouldn't have anticipated projecting forward from, you know, the 90s was obviously what would happen with the internet. What the fact that there's something about the anonymity on the internet, or the relative anonymity, and I'm sure Xbox Live users can attest to this, that brings out the incivility.
Oh, I've had to mute so many people on Xbox Live, and I don't even use it that much.
I think we've pretty much got zealotry in general as probably... It pretty sound. I think for the world, it would probably be a better place if, in general.
Yeah, I really would like some more religious zealotry if you could.
Absolutely.
Perhaps it's a little more reasonable to expect it to die down in the games industry, but it isn't going to happen. I think that's been proven over the last few years. I think my next one is about pricing. It's about software pricing. The sort of rigidity that we see in the retail market, I think, really does need to die. And you could, I think it, to some extent it is somewhat already, but still, the diversity of games that come out for the same price, I just think is somewhat fundamentally out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other element of it is, I think, to some extent, the diversity of games is being actually compressed by pricing. You know, that developers feel like there are certain expectations that they have to fulfill if a game is coming out for a certain price, but then the game pretty much has to come out for that price, so they kind of get forced into, you know, maybe included certain things that might not be the most optimal use of their development time, like, you know, maybe multiplayer or certain online functionality or whatever, you know, which really is kind of extraneous stuff, and maybe you'd be better off specialising on what you've got there. So I really think, you know, and obviously this is something that is radically going to change as digital distribution takes a greater hold, but I still feel like we're quite far away from that, especially if you look at what Nintendo's doing. Retail is going to be very important for a number of years to come yet. But in that time, I do hope at least that perhaps the parallel market of digital distribution will help more price flexibility into the market, because I think ultimately that is going to help developers have a more rational development process and actually put the money where it belongs, bring a game out at the right kind of price point, and that, you know, we don't have this idea anymore that if a game comes out at a certain price point, that it's like an inferior game,
mm-hmm.
a budget title. You know, that's the point. You know, if a game comes out at $30 or so, it's a budget title. which kind of makes you think of other things that are budget, which are inferior goods.
Yeah.
And that is not, to me, that is just an unhealthy paradox. Like, you know, if they put together the kind of game that is appropriate to come out for $30, and they can make their money back on it for $30, why not? And that doesn't have to say anything about the quality of it.
Well, I mean, Johnny was just talking about that with Shoot One Up. I mean, that game cost him, what, a dollar?
Yes.
It was great.
I think the opposite point here is that the $60 price point for games is just...
It's too much.
It is. I know they can sell AAA titles at that, but I do wonder if it hurts the sales of, not just because it costs more of the less than AAA titles, but because people have to spend more money on these big games and end up spending money they probably wouldn't have spent otherwise.
Yeah, at the end of the day, if you say, look, there's a certain number of people in the market that want to spend money on video games, those people have a certain amount of money to spend on video games, there's rivalry for that money, and you're essentially redistributing it to a select few titles rather than a broad range of titles,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which might help the EAs and the Activisions of the world. But on the other hand, it doesn't necessarily bode well for a sort of vibrant, healthy development scene with a sort of diverse range of capability. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point.
My I'm not buying $60 games isn't so much a political statement as it is a budgetary
practical.
One.
Yeah.
I mean, I have the money to buy every game I want to buy.
But see, the thing is, though,
there's no reason to.
I mean, James, like, you know as well as I do that unless you want to buy it day one, you don't have to buy it for $60.
Exactly.
There's like this market, there's like this constant market correction going on, which is something I'll never understand. Like, you can't tell me if a AAA game was priced at $40, everybody would buy it new. You might have the real, real cheap people who wait for it to drop to $30 or $20 or something like that, but I mean, really.
Look, if Modern Warfare 2 were $50, I would already own it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have bought it new, because generally speaking, I don't like to buy my games used, but if they're $60, you're not giving me a lot of choices.
Yeah.
And the thing is, even the budget, I mean, even the used game market is still somewhat rigid, because it's basically, $4 to $6 off of the retail
price.
Yeah,
it's a sort of shadow market.
Yeah, so it's just, I mean, in the end, with a 10% discount, I paid $10 less for a $60 game. So,
Yeah. I mean, but what you get, where you're concerned about, the used game market or this, that, and the other, is developers start developing things differently. It's like, well, we've got to give incentives for people to not trade it in. So maybe we hold some back for DLC. And we do...
Or you give away DLC with it, like, which is EA's new strategy.
Yeah, exactly. All this kind of stuff. And it's just like, I'm not really comfortable with the idea of basically some of these commercial aspects really affecting the way that you develop a game and plan the content release and stuff like that. And I think a lot of the reason that it does is because it is as inflexible as it is. I think, if it was more responsive, then you wouldn't have to get into some of these problems. As you said, there is a certain amount of flexibility after release.
Mm-hmm.
But at opening, how many games are willing to sort of say, we are a budget game.
Yeah.
Not many. Because
no.
it's a badge of dishonor, if you like.
Yeah, it's stigmatized.
Well, I mean, that's
a stigma.
That's why the whole phrase AAA came out to begin with. It's we're not we didn't cut any corners here.
Exactly, and that's where you get into box ticking. That's where you get into, we are a AAA game. We are worth the price that all these games open for, but only some of them are actually worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only time I might ever consider buying a $60 game is if Atlas is publishing it, because there's a very real chance I will never see that game again. Because they have made 4 copies of it, and everybody knows there's only 4 copies in existence.
Well, have we got any final things that we would like to see?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would love to see, just a quick hit here, I would love to see peripheral-based games completely just go down the shitter. I'm so tired of having... of plastic crap in my room for every single kind of game I have. I'm sick of it.
Steel Battalion isn't plastic crap.
I'm sick of it. I'm just waiting for the game where they actually give you a plastic robot suit to hop into. And so you're sitting there walking around like a robot.
Like I said, Steel Battalion.
Next generation, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
You wait.
So mine is day one DLC, which we'd kind of touched on earlier.
Yes.
Because if your game is just fucking coming out, DLC is supposed to add things that weren't available when the game was done.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be like, hey, here's some other stuff to sell you, sucker.
Or also day one patches that fix your broken game.
That was my next one.
Yeah.
How about patches on my video games?
It's like, what? I haven't even pulled this thing out of the wrapper. It's like patching itself on the shelf. It's like, come on.
Look, I understand the complexities of releasing bug-free software.
I know.
Because I've never done it. However, I also understand that there are people who can't update their video games because they don't have them hooked up to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I also understand that that's really goddamn annoying.
Oh, yeah, and there's plenty of games like that on the PS3 and 360 where... The PS3 I find is especially bad for it, where the worst game I've ever seen is Hot Shots Golf, where you literally have to sit there. Like, when you first pop it in, you will literally sit there for 2 hours and update it.
Oh, my God.
I'm not kidding. I couldn't believe it. It is so long to update it.
Was it TYP who had turned on his PS3 to update it and left it on for 2 weeks by accident? I'm trying to remember who that was. I do think another trope that we go with are... the really, really bad sci-fi plot. I'm looking at you, Conduit.
Yeah. The shadow conspiracy, the conspiracy against the government.
Stuff that's so bad that, like, I can't play it with people around because the story's just too embarrassing and they might hear parts of it.
So, for this one, we say games that you can only play alone.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't mind playing games alone, but games that I'm embarrassed to play in front of people. How about that?
Games that, if you're playing alone, make you look over your shoulder just to check that you are.
Well, that could enter a whole new category of games, though.
Well, maybe. Well, any final submissions before we wrap this up and move on to a little bit of listener mail?
Yeah, I got one more. For some reason, I don't know if this happens on anybody else's Wii, but when I download stuff, for some reason at the very end, you know where Mario it goes on for like a full minute. I have to sit there and turn down the TV.
That's one of those look over your shoulder moments, because I had my sister over one day when I was downloading Muscle March, which is a game, game you have to play in private.
Failed from the start.
And it's just going bing 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 bing. She's like, "What is that?" I'm like, "I don't just leave it alone." How about just the freaking progress bar?
Yeah.
So the final thing we've decided needs to die is Mario. That's sad.
Yep.
That could be it. That's the episode title.
Mario must die. I mean,
must die.
That's it. I mean, it's been a great 25 years, I guess.
Well, we are now going to move on to some listener mail, still trying to work through what we've accumulated here. And all these messages have a bit of a nostalgic tint to them.
Because they're old?
No, not because they're old, actually, for once. We are moving towards the present. But obviously, something about listening to this show makes you reminisce about the past if you're a listener. So,
because John's still living there.
The first one is James. You have this one.
Moore's in Germany writes, this is a shortened version of his very happily complimentary email, which we appreciate.
Yeah, it's really just a question from it, but we certainly appreciate the very complimentary preamble.
His question is, how do particular games, or games in general, influence your perception of the environment you live in? For instance, there are certain smells or objects, a certain food or piece of beloved furniture, for instance, that belongs to your experience? Recently at my parents, my old TV from 1992 died on me. I recalled hours of playing SNES, N64, and GameCube, and was sad to see it and its remote control go.
Well, I would say for me it was my original NES, for sure, because I can still remember. I think I bought it at KB Toys or something. I remember I was actually with my family in Florida, because we went down every year to Florida. And so that was when I would go down there and buy a slew of games, because they were all cheaper. And they all had, at that time, that was when games weren't released in Canada and the U.S. at the same time.
Oh, that's right. I was wondering why it's like...
They always came to Canada like 6 months afterwards. Really sucked. And so you would go down to the U.S. and you would see all of these games and just be like, oh my God, like, you know, games that you'd never seen and none of your friends could buy.
Well, you know, if you all didn't insist on speaking French up there, this wouldn't be a problem.
Thanks, Bob Costas. And so, yeah, so I remember when I bought it, I think I bought Castlevania with it and maybe one other game. But yeah, but I still have that thing in the box. I still have Castlevania in the box and everything. So that's like kind of like one of my holy grails.
I think one thing for me is Christmas always reminds me of Super Ghouls and Ghosts. the first Christmas we had the Super Famicom, we had it, you know, earlier in the year and played Mario World and all that, but the first Christmas game for it was Super Ghouls and Ghosts. So I was insanely excited for that game. Mm-hmm. At the time, so just the whole, you know, whenever you get the mince pies on or the Christmas pud with a bit of brandy, it does sometimes.
This is culturally irrelevant to both John and myself.
Hey, the brandy, I'm down with that, man.
Culturally relevant.
That will remind me of Ghouls and Ghosts. Reminds me of triumphing over the first level during Christmas Day.
Oh, it's horrible.
Whereas, you know, Donkey Kong Country was done by Boxing Day.
It's kind of funny you mentioned that, because it sort of reminds me of the game that I link to Christmas, and this is a tragedy, is Donkey Kong 64. And I do that because I remember it was a really, really bad Christmas, mm-hmm. family-wise. Like, just all kinds of shit had happened. So I basically buried myself in that stupid-ass game, collecting bananas.
Oh, no.
While I don't know how old I was then, but I was trying to just not deal with the crap going on around me at the time. So for about a month, I went and harvested bananas, and I hate collecting games, but that game, like when I hear mentions of that game, it's always like, you need 241 more bananas. And my response always at the time was just, F you, I don't need any more bananas. You're going to open this damn door right now. Which it never worked, but it made me feel better.
Yeah, so other than Christmas food, I really can't think of any food that would be associated with it. I'm sure Johnny obviously could, the innumerable games that he's played with Gamer Grub.
That's right.
He's probably eating some right now at the concert, I mean.
He's got the pouch has the easy pour scoop. It's funny because he mentioned, our letter writer mentioned TV, and mm-hmm. when I was growing up, we had this old, like 1979 color Zenith with the dials and shit, and that was the upstairs TV, and it's we had cable, and the upstairs TV did not have a coax input. It had the two screws that you had to attach the prongs to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Yeah, that's old school.
So you had to get the RF adapter for your NES, and I remember when we first put a video game system on there, it was the Intellivision that I ruined my parents' opportunity to enjoy by being born. that I remember playing B-17 Flying Fortress with the voice box that for some reason they bought, and hearing the most terrifying sounds of a person trying to render the word flak with a computer. like I can't describe how it was done to people, but like at best it would be going like frrr. But it would just be over and over again, and it was just so bizarre. Like, my TV's talking to me, but he kind of sounds like he's a little bit retarded. But I'm being shot at, so I don't have time to deal with it.
Well, TVs weren't as smart back then. We all know that. They've evolved a lot as a species.
I was bad that, right? Because, you know, you could only play foreign games on relatively modern TV sets. You know, because it was NTSC, it's a completely different kind of signal.
Right.
So, you know, you couldn't just shunt the Super Famicom onto some crappy TV in another room. It had to go on the proper one. All right, well, we better get on to the next question. Actually, I think I'll do this one. This is Mike in West Virginia. He writes, I am a 38-year-old gamer. My history with video games has followed a trajectory which may be considered unusual. I had a friend in fourth grade who had an original Atari that we'd play for hours. A proud memory of mine is getting the high score on Laser Blaster, taking a Polaroid picture of the screen to send on to the developers, although nothing else ever actually came of that.
Because they had gone bankrupt.
No patches for you. I also spent an inordinate amount of time playing a table version of Miss Pac-Man at a neighborhood Mexican eatery while hopped up on Mountain Dew. From there, another friend of mine had a Nintendo system when we played Donkey Kong Jr. along with Super Mario Bros. For hours on end. Later, Super Mario Bros. 2 came out and I really couldn't get into that or the original Zelda. Not long after this, I graduated high school and went to college and stopped playing games altogether, excepting my brother's Aladdin game on Sega, which was actually quite good. Anywho, I tried Wii Sports at a friend's house a few years ago, and long story short, I am hooked again. Playing Super Mario Galaxy was like playing Super Mario Bros. For the first time. Love it. Naturally, I was excited about New Super Mario Bros. Wii coming out and played and beat New Super Mario Bros. For DS in anticipation of it. I was proud, although I know many seasoned players consider it to be quite an easy game. I know this email is rambly, but if there is a question to be asked, it is about the lackluster response from you all in regard to New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I have played through the first few worlds and have found it to be quite fun, especially in multiplayer and challenging in single player mode as well. Did you all just find it too easy and have already beaten it and moved on? It just seemed that there was a lot of anticipation before its release, and now it is not really discussed at all. Just in the limited amount of playing time I've put into it so far, I am very impressed with the level design and the creative new items and ways to obtain extra lives. So, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, yeah, so many months on. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think the reason probably why it just doesn't come up more often from me or perhaps anyone else is just that it is very much what I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're not inclined to comment on things that are as expected.
Hey, I woke up and the sky wasn't green.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, and also the fact that it doesn't stray too far from the DS version either, so...
Exactly. I mean, that's what you expect. You expect the DS version, you know, with some of the quibbles, you know, that there were about that game addressed. Obviously, the multiplayer being a really big new component there, and that's, you know, pretty much what you get. And I'm very pleased with it. I really enjoyed playing through the single player. I'm not really ideally sort of situated to fully exploit the multiplayer for what it's worth, but what I've played of it, I have enjoyed. But it is just kind of a does what it says on the tin situation.
Yep.
And so, it just doesn't really provoke further comment. But I mean, I think it's fair that the level design is quite a significant step up on the DS game. I just think it's more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, he is actually, what's interesting, I think he is actually an interesting case because it's almost like he's stepped out of a time warp into today's video game market.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, when they talk about the lapsed gamer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is quite an extraordinary case of that.
I want us to caution from discussing this as an academic, you know, like a research subject, because this is a listener, after all.
Exactly, but I think it's incredible that, you know, when we talk about, there is talk about the lapsed gamer, and it's a bit of an abstract sort of concept, you know, when you see it in those terms. But you've got someone, you know, that goes so far back with games, and yet obviously it didn't persist. But then, you know, Wii Sports, you know, which is, you know, not that similar to Mario Brothers or whatever you were doing on the Atari as well, you know, has rekindled the interest. And then, you know, you get to a point where you're listening to a podcast about it. I mean, it is quite a remarkable case study, I think. But it also goes to show that, you know, Nintendo's intent with what they were doing with Wii really has done what they wanted it to in certain cases. You know, that certainly the simpler kind of appeal of something like Wii Sports is just something that could do that, whereas, you know, what was populating, or certainly what was the most publicized things about gaming in, you know, the previous generations just were not going to do that.
Yeah, well, I also like the fact that it kind of shows that, once again, good game concepts really don't have an expiry date. I mean, even though Wii Sports was the kind of new concept, I mean, he immediately moved on to, you know, Mario,
yeah,
you know, stuff like that.
I think conceptually you can say that, but I think game design itself does have an expiration date.
I don't know. I think Tetris would probably disagree with you.
Well, it depends on the game.
I think the question really is just how fundamentally sound it was in the first place, isn't it? I think certain things get exposed.
Well, here's an interesting question for you. Do you think that game design itself, because of the move to 3D, do you think it's actually regressed?
I think if you think about it, people discuss with graphics, they dropped off when we went to 3D, because you could no longer animate the sprites, you know, you couldn't spend and make every last little detail perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think in the same way, you couldn't create an engine that was perfect because of the extra complexity of 3D and limitations of the hardware.
I think the thing about where game design's gone is that it's necessarily been less focused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you have so much more to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, you probably do see people have a certain appetite for things like a new Super Mario Bros. Wii or a Mega Man 9 or whatever, because it's very focused, because the core concepts, the core of the game is already done.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, whatever development efforts have gone into it have gone into exploiting that, and you know, really kind of the real payoff mm-hmm. of it all.
Yeah. But would you say that as a general rule that games from 1985, just because they were more trimmed down in a way and kind of, I guess, if they were going to be good, their design had to be really tight. Would you say that games from 85 would age better than games from 95?
No.
Well, if you talk about games of 95 that are on the PlayStation or the Saturn, then yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, that's what I mean by 3D, right? Like 3D kind of...
Yeah, but those games weren't really that good to begin with. I mean, Gex was never a good game.
True, true.
But that's what they were preying on, was technical novelty. You know, so that's why they've dated as sorely as anything.
But see, but the thing is, though, but even games like, say, Final Fantasy VII... which is supposedly a classic game. You play that game now and people are like, yeah, you know, it hasn't aged as well as I thought it would.
But if you put a new veneer on that game, you know, new graphics and stuff, what would you say? Do you think it would have aged fine?
I might like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that game as it stands, though, whereas you could throw in, you know, something on the NES from 85 and you don't have to put any new veneer on it. It still plays just as well as it did.
Well, I think we're just more accepting of the graphics of that time period than we are of the 3D games, in part because we have that nostalgia factor kicking in.
Yeah, I think there's a part of
I think definitely. I mean, look at the original Zelda game. That game is hideous.
True.
I mean, it, plain ugly.
No, that's the thing, I guess, in some ways, you know, the games that were the most progressive at the time have kind of aged the worst, because you kind of see what they were reaching for has been attained to a much larger extent.
Or over and over again since then.
Yeah, whereas, you know, the games that were more happy within the limitations that they had at the time tend to age the best.
I mean, honestly, if we want to talk about games that aged badly, Mortal frickin' Kombat.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, again, it's the name of that was preying on novelty. Because of the
it was, but I think a lot of games, even back in the early days of the NES, they were preying on novelty. I mean, rob your remote operating buddy. I mean,
exactly.
Come on.
But certainly when you got to like the 16-bit kind of period, and it's like, okay, we can experiment with 3D, we experiment with pre-rendered graphics, experiment with digitized graphics, all this stuff, and of course the early CD games, FMV.
Oh no!
That was the real awkward phase, which dated the worst.
To bring it back to the question, Mike in West Virginia, he missed all of that.
He's a lucky guy.
Think about it.
Remember when we were growing up and we went through all of these phases of like, oh my god, Mortal Kombat's faces are real faces.
Sewer Shark, he missed that. I mean,
oh.
Night Trap, come on.
Night Trap, yeah.
Well, we all missed Night Trap. Yeah. But I wonder what that would do to your perception of games during that time period in which you didn't play them.
Well, I think Mike, actually, if you want to send us in a subsequent email, maybe if you ever get into the virtual console, I don't know, the problem is they're never going to put Mega CD games on there, but, you know.
Well, here's how I'll explain it. Like, imagine if you went into stasis in 1912.
See, this is the whole thing. You can't help but look at it as some sort of weird science experiment.
I know.
It's fascinating. It's like,
Just listen.
I want to meet this guy and, like, just pick his brain.
You went to sleep in 1912 and woke up and it was 1919.
This guy's a walking what-if scenario.
Not much has changed around you, but the whole fucking world went through just craziness for 6 years. I mean,
I think it's definitely better to have had this kind of thing than to go into stasis, you know, acting alongside people like Ian Holm and then waking up and acting alongside Paul Reiser.
Oh, but I mean, like, it's hard to have an objective opinion of this stuff because you can see what happened to it afterwards. And it's hard for us to have an objective opinion because we lived it.
Exactly. Either way, you're kind of colored.
He can draw the conclusions and see that Mode 7 didn't do crap, or he can understand that the N64 cartridges were an instrument of Nintendo's temporary demise.
Oh, well, we'll move on to the last one, which I think is a pretty... It segues quite nicely from the discussion we just had, so John, if you want to get this one.
All right, Dan in Pennsylvania writes, I sat down to play some Super Mario Bros. Lost Levels this morning and subconsciously tried shaking the controller to lengthen my jump, butt stomping, picking up shells, and thinking I was safer with flower power since I could take an extra hit. Mental fail. Also, I can't really remember another game where the level design is clearly intended to deceive and kill you outright. you guys ever run into a similar "what the fuck am I doing" moment going back to an old game? Or are there any other games you've played where it was clearly the designers maliciously watched game testers to learn and verify how to get gamers to fall for fatal traps? Ninja Gaiden. Ninja Gaiden on the NES. Go and play that. Actually, don't.
I'm trying to think of games that... I mean, Ninja Gaiden is an obvious one.
Yeah, it's a good one, definitely.
Yep.
In some ways, like Mega Man X and Mega Man X2 and X3 are just gruelingly nasty. Like, there are stages where it's basically just like, you have to jump from one side of the wall to the other, back and forth, but the walls are closing in on you, and they will crush you. And it's just like, who designed this masochism?
Yeah.
And you have to wait till the walls are close enough together to jump to the next one, which means you're already playing with fire. It's like, why? Why did they do this?
I think the interesting, the idea of, like, you know, your expectations of what games are, you know, affecting sort of how you would play. Obviously, some of, you know, the things you can do in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, corrupting his ability to play old school Mario with the lost levels there. Obviously, I'm someone that does a lot of, you know, I play a lot of virtual console stuff, so, you know, there isn't like a culture shock when I play old games because I've just been, you know, playing them pretty regularly for years now. But I think the most pernicious thing, rather than just like, oh, you're thinking you can do specific things, and I've had that, you know, when you play all these like Nintendo games that are in the same series, you'll do stuff like that. Like, I desperately wanted to use the shoulder buttons going back to Super Metroid after Zero Mission. And it's like, no, actually, you've just got to cycle through the switches on the thing to go to, like, missiles and super missiles and power bombs. Like, what? And you'd constantly just do the shoulder buttons things just because that was more intuitive. And it's like, no, it still didn't do it that way. Sorry. But I think more dangerous than that is just, like, your expectations about how things work. Like, if you play an older school game where you get to a point and you die and you realize the checkpoint was actually really far back.
Oh.
Relative to sort of modern expectations, that is very likely to make you go, no, don't fancy playing this anymore. You know?
Yeah. Or even games where you can't save your game. I mean, there's been some of those where you'll get old, you'll get an old game and you'll be like, wait a minute, I can't save my game. Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
How in the, like, some of those old NES games?
Those are the things that I think make you least able to actually play them. You know, not so much like literally compromising your ability, but really your willingness.
Your desire to play.
You have different standards now, and it's just like what was acceptable years ago just becomes this is bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you could walk to work every day, but you don't because they developed cars to...
Yeah, because cars exist.
Yeah.
That's the thing. See, I'm relatively, at this point, pretty conditioned to that kind of stuff, really. Mm-hmm. You know, played a lot of old games, but definitely I could see that.
Yeah, well, it's like, that's why it's like on the VC, it's great because you can sort of pause it.
Yeah, I think the suspend feature does actually add quite a lot, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a game that has like a bunch... Oh, I got it. F-Zero GX. There is a game that literally just says, hey, what? Fuck you.
Yeah.
And then it's like, hey, what's that blind jump? Oh, you didn't take the jump.
Yep.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Trial and error this 1,000 more times and maybe you'll get it.
Yeah, I'm more accepting of that in any racing game, whether it's modern or retro, because it's going to be about learning the tracks. I mean, whether it kills you or not.
But there's a difference when you learn the track versus, hey, you failed to learn the track 3 times, now rerun the entire racing
circuit. Yeah, see, that's harsh in terms of, you know, the number of lives thing, but yeah, I think that could have been fixed by just giving you more lives.
Like, why can't I drive all my opponents off the track and then just leisurely coast around it? If since I'm apparently as lethal as can possibly be.
Well, certainly in F-Zero X, I mean, that was kind of possible. I mean, you could...
Yeah.
GX, it was a lot harder to just annihilate your opponents.
Since apparently you die at the drop of a hat, why don't they?
Well, I mean, I tell you what, though. I mean, of stuff that I have played, Lost Levels is pretty damn special. Because that is mental, the stuff they're doing in that. Like, you're supposed to, like, hit hidden blocks, you know, like, really up high to be able to jump across to a gap. And you've got the wind affecting your jump, you know, how long you can jump. And it is crazy. I mean, it really, you know, everyone said, you know, the line about Lost Levels or, you know, the real Super Mario Brothers 2 from Japan, or if you were looking at it, is that it's like a ROM hack. And it really is.
Well, in fact, there's a ROM hack of it that's really not that much harder.
Well, it's just this kind of, you know, obtuse school of level design.
Mm-hmm.
I played it on the virtual console. I played it up to, I think, the 7th world before I got just too stuck to continue. It's got to be the most, just, I think, the most cynical thing I've ever played. I mean, you could talk about stuff in terms of level design. You know, like, you talk about, like, Super Ghouls and Ghosts, a lot of the sort of problems that people have is just with the basic way that game works.
Yeah, the controls more than anything.
Yeah, you can't control your jump in the air and stuff like that. Or you know, similar things with Castlevania. But this is purely, like, it controls exactly like Mario. I mean, the fundamentals is exactly the same as the first one. So it's all about the level design.
Yeah. I think Battletoads.
Yes,
definitely Battletoads.
The stupid motorbike level. Mm-hmm. You know what? About 20 years later, I still can't beat it. I had it on the Game Boy and the NES, so I could play that crap when I was on the go, and I still never beat that stupid motorbike.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, it basically demands such slavish learning. Like, you basically just have to sit there and devote hours and hours and hours of your time to beat it once, and it means nothing.
The next level, because...
You know what I mean? That's the whole thing. There's no payoff to it. It's just another level in the game.
No, so, I mean, I think that's really where, you know, the way that you could overcome these things in the past was just that's the way it was. You know, there's nothing unreasonable about this request.
No.
For me to, exactly, you know, try and master this over the course of several weeks or whatever, you know.
Several years. Well, you know, we've mentioned a bunch of NES games, but what about the SNES or the N64 or anything?
Well, you say you got those Mega Man games. Or the X,
yeah,
games.
Those are just freaking terrible. I mean, I love them, but they are just nasty, ugly, yeah, gross, pain, suffering, destruction. Oh, like Smash TV, but that's, you know, that's,
oh,
a,
yeah, Smash TV is pretty,
but that's, you know, that's an arcade game, so it's,
yeah,
it's,
exactly, see, that's the thing. What I love are the ones that were just in the home and yet were every bit as punitive and illogical as arcade.
That's absolutely it. Punitive and illogical, that's what so many of those, like, old school games were.
You mean like the Battletoads for the SNES, which was equally punitive? I mean, honestly, I don't think I ever beat the first level of that game. It's just criminal. I can't think of, but I...
Well, if you want something, I tell you what, it's a good example of just a thoroughly befuddling design choice. It's Castlevania 64.
That's befuddling on a lot of levels.
Well, it is, but there's a part in the game where you're trying to blow up a crack in the wall somewhere. And so you have to carry, like, one component of you know, what you're going to make to blow up this wall around with you. But basically, if you take damage or you have, like, a significant kind of fall or something like that, you know, basically if you, like, jump too high or something, I think, even, you blow up. So you have this whole ridiculously long sequence of, like, you know, gears and enemies and platforms, all this stuff where you can only jump in, like, tiny little increments, I think, or otherwise, nice, you blow up. And it's like, what the hell is this doing in the middle of this game?
Welcome to hell.
Well, I mean, it's so random because, you know, it's like that. It's not a particularly good game in a lot of ways, but it's not really like a old school kind of sensibility to it for the most part. And then all of a sudden, this thing just comes along where it's like instant death is suddenly, you know, fashionable. I mean, to be fair, it's pretty hard to die instantly apart from falling in a pit, even in the original Castlevania. You know, you do have a health bar.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a hidden trap or anything like what Dan's talking about. You know, you are aware of this, but you still can't believe it.
It's just too bizarre.
All right, well, that is going to close us out for this week. So thanks to all those that wrote in. Of course, if you want to write in for non-nostalgic questions, we're certainly open to that as well. You could do so at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So, Johnny, hopefully, will be back.
Or will he?
Well, we'll see. next week is going to be the last episode before PAX East.
Yes.
So expect plenty of excited anticipation.
Lots
from
of
the three
cliffhangers,
there.
I think. Well, we'll just have to wait next week. I'll see you in person. You know, stuff like that. I mean, I think they'll...
to kill you.
Yeah, there'll probably be threats exchanged.
Right, save it for the show. In person.
That's the end of the show. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, bye-bye.
Later.
How about firmware updates to my consoles? I don't really need that. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, like the 360 NXE, as they call it.
Yeah.
Did that make anybody's life better? Now
no.
that I have a visualized virtual version of Johnny dressed as kind of like a douche on my front page. You haven't seen it, man. You don't know.
No, I haven't.
That's gonna get a response next week.
I heard Johnny actually. He's in home trying to find something for his avatar. He's trying to find a harmonica for his home avatar.
Oh, this is how long it took, is it?
Well, it's
before it descends into the old ways.
Well, you know, it's
days.
Funny because I've got like 4 or 5 people that I know what they look like on there, and it doesn't look anything like that.
Exactly.
Like I've got Johnny and Billy right next to each other. I'm like, no, very no.
I'm also tired of being sold on gaming as a lifestyle.
To be fair, when you stay up till 3:30 in the morning playing Mass Effect 2, it becomes a lifestyle.
Well, it's
certainly like, highly influential on your lifestyle.
When you look down and go like, I didn't eat dinner today.
Bye, Gamer Aid. It will help you in your gaming lifestyle.
Now I just have the image of Johnny and his pouched food from E3 that he used to cut.
Just doing the spit take with his gamer grub as he listens back to the episode.
Gamer grub. Oh, God. He'll never live that down, just like his card game playing
Magic
the Gathering.
When he tried to live it down, he wrote a blog about it.
I know.
I did finish off Dragon Age, which is... kind of like the worst ending in an RPG I've ever played.
Oh, although he's gonna be more measured with your comments this week.
No, look, it is the least climactic boss battle I've ever seen. I'm just gonna leave that at that.
You obviously didn't get the ending.
Oh no, I didn't. Well, I'm not talking about the ending, like isn't the story ending, but just the actual boss battle itself.
Oh, I was joking, by the way. I don't know if
yeah,
such
I understood that.
That game.
You don't know what Dikembe Mutombo is, I know, Johnny.
That's right. Yes.
You just heard it online.
Exactly. Oh, I'm just repeating words I heard at school. Mommy, please don't punish me.
Oh, dear.